You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
On the periphery of these other states, you know, that Russia is not even allowed to compete with the U.S. on its own borders. China is not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the South China Sea, even though it's called the South China Sea. Iran is not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the Persian Gulf. You know, Persia is not allowed to control the Persian Gulf. This explains a lot of what's happening. The U.S. really is at war with pretty much the whole world at this point.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights lawyer. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik is the featured speaker Thursday, September 7th at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, starting at 7:30 p.m. This event is part of the KPFA Speaker Series. Today we discuss the Cold War, the allegations against Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation, the Yeltsin years in Russia, Nicaragua and Colombia, Afghanistan, Yemen, U.S. imperialism, and endless war. Dan Kovalik, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, you point out, of course, that the vilification of Russia is really nothing new and dates back a couple of centuries. What does seem to be new, though, is the vilification of the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Historically, do you know of any other Russian leader who has been demonized the way Putin has come under attack in the West?
Certainly not a sitting leader. You know, no one that I know of has been attacked while they were the head of the Russian state. As Stephen F. Cohen has pointed out, in fact, there's been a lot of examples of U.S. presidents having warm relationships with the heads of Russia, or during the first Cold War, the heads of the Soviet Union. So, you know, Kennedy ended up having a warm relationship with Khrushchev. Nixon had a good relationship with Brezhnev. Reagan obviously became very close to Gorbachev, and they ended the Cold War together. And initially, you might recall that George W. Bush considered Putin a friend. In fact, he said, "I looked into Putin's eyes and I saw his soul." And so that is the typical type of relationship with standing leaders of Russia. And yeah, now, of course, as you mentioned, it's something new where Putin has been vilified to the point that I've never seen any other leader vilified, truthfully.
What have the charges against Russia and Putin consisted of, and who and what organizations have been making these accusations?
Well, again, this has been going on for some time. Things even began to chill during George W. Bush's tenure, in part because while Putin was the first leader, I'll just remind folks, world leader to call George W. Bush and express his condolences after 9/11 and offer help in Afghanistan with Bush's operations, and he did give that help. Things did begin to sour in 2003 when Putin did not go along with the invasion of Iraq, which he saw as wrong-headed and something that would only increase terrorism. And, of course, history has shown that Putin was absolutely correct in that. Under Obama, there was a thaw under Medvedev, who was president during some of Obama's tenure. In fact, Obama said he wanted to reboot or reset relations with Russia under Medvedev. But things got sour with Medvedev and Putin for a number of reasons, but in large part because of the Libya invasion that Obama was one of the leaders of. You might recall that the U.S. went to the Security Council to set up a no-fly zone over Libya under the pretense of protecting human rights. By the way, all of the justifications it gave for that no-fly zone quickly fell apart. But nonetheless, Russia and China agreed to abstain on the vote for the no-fly zone resolution under the condition that the no-fly zone would not morph into regime change. Of course, it did quickly morph into regime change with Gaddafi being overthrown. He was famously murdered after being sodomized, all on video, which one could watch on YouTube if they have the stomach. And apparently Putin did watch the video and was repulsed by it. And this is when I think Putin himself begins to really distrust the United States, and things begin to go sour. So this has been a long line of incidents and people who have led us down the path to where we are now.
Donald Trump has been accused of somehow colluding with Vladimir Putin and Russia since well before the presidential election. Trump is now in the eighth month of his presidency. What concrete evidence of this Russian collusion has been confirmed?
Well, very little of it. First of all, John Pilger, a journalist I really respect, said he said there's not even really allegations, you know, much less proven ones. But what are the allegations? One, the kind of the font of it all is the allegation that Putin was behind the alleged hacking of the DNC emails, Podesta's emails that end up being released by WikiLeaks. There's little to no evidence, truthfully, that Russia did it. In fact, there's a recent study that was put out by the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity who did a study saying that they in fact believe that the DNC computer was not hacked at all, but that it was leaked, that someone on the inside copied the emails, put them on a disk or flash drive, and that they were stolen that way, not through a remote hack. And so that's part of the story. Again, the font of all this just seemed to fall apart. So then all we're left with are alleged meetings. And most recently, and this came out this week, there's some emails that were released where some real estate mogul who's from Russia claimed he could help Trump get elected, and that part of this process through Putin, and that part of this process would involve Trump's building a new property in Russia, I believe a new hotel. And a lot of people have made hay of this, saying, hey, this guy said, hey, I can get you in the White House with the help of Putin. And this proves, you know, collusion. But actually, there's a story today which kind of points out the obvious. If you look at the Washington Post story on this, what's clear is nothing happened with this claim by this intermediary. That is to say, the building, Trump's building, was never built in Russia. The intermediary who says I can help you get elected through Putin admits in the same emails, and this is in, you know, the mainstream press now, that once Trump's campaign began in earnest sometime in November to December of 2015, all of his efforts around the hotel and Putin ended. That is to say, the story collapses on itself. And one sees the headline, which is, hey, you know, there's this Russian expat that bragged he could help Trump get elected through Putin, but it just turned out this was a hollow brag. And again, most of these incidents fall apart when you really look at them. You know, the bottom line is always nothing happened. And so I think we will see very little to no evidence about this type of collusion. But that hasn't stopped the press, of course, from obsessing about it 24/7.
And what organizations and people, in addition to the mainstream media, are lobbying these charges against Russia colluding with the Trump election? And what about the hacks of the DNC emails? You've mentioned that. Now, who else besides the mainstream media keep lobbying these charges?
Well, of course, you have the Democratic Party, and particularly the folks aligned with Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, who obviously are trying to make political hay out of this. And we know from the book Shattered that came out this year that John Podesta himself, right after the election, came up with the idea to blame Hillary's loss on Russia. For obvious reasons. If she had any chance of running again, it was seen as convenient to blame, you know, another country instead of blaming Hillary herself for running a poor campaign, which I think she did. I mean, the other interesting fact is Comey's now become this hero because he started going after Trump for the Russia collusion. So you have Comey, you have other folks in the FBI, you have folks in the CIA who made it clear that they do not want to rapprochement with Russia. They made it clear that Trump was wrong in seeking such a detente with Russia. And it seems that all these groups together in the press have succeeded in preventing a detente with Russia. So when Trump meets with Putin at the G20 recently, for example, one, it's like a big deal. It's somehow treasonous that he even met him, especially because they found out he had a secret one-hour meeting that folks didn't know about to begin with, again, which is fairly typical for heads of state. But in any case, instead of being congratulated for meeting with Putin and coming to some agreements on cooperation in Syria and the Ukraine, Trump is largely criticized for meeting with Putin. And then right after this, Congress overwhelmingly approves a new round of sanctions against Russia right after the president agrees with Putin to act cooperatively. Again, clearly intended to derail any chance of Trump and Putin working together on anything. So it seems to me there's a lot of folks in the government, including in the Congress, both Republican and Democrat, and in the press, who do not want to see any good relationship with Russia.
Now, why do you think that is? Obviously, the Democratic Party doesn't want a rapprochement with Russia. The intelligence agencies don't seem to want it, or a large part of the intelligence agencies. The media has gotten on the bandwagon, of course. Then there's a question about the military-industrial complex. Where do they stand on this? Why is it that all of these powerful forces, in your opinion, do not want to have good relations with the Russian Federation?
Well, I think, of course, if we start with the military-industrial complex, there's obvious reasons there. You know, obviously, they benefit from a war, and that's becoming a huge part of the U.S. economy, is war. In fact, Congress ended up giving Trump more money in the military budget than he even asked for. And he was already asking for an increase, which was equivalent to 80% of Russia's entire military budget. Meanwhile, Putin has announced a 25% decrease in his military, I'll note.
I'm speaking with human rights attorney and author Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
There are obviously vested interests in having war all the time. In fact, they used to say, you know, the business of the U.S. is business. I think the business of the U.S. is now war. And, you know, you see us fighting on multiple fronts in wars that seem to go on without end. Afghanistan, of course, is an example. And they seem to go on without end by design. And again, a rapprochement with Russia would risk possibly peace breaking out, which folks don't want. So I think that's one thing that's happening. I think the other thing that's happening is that a lot of folks in power and in the ruling class see that the economic system is in grave crisis. We had, of course, the huge recession of 2008, which was, you know, nearly catastrophic. We really haven't recovered since then, though. You know, there's claims that we have, but it's clear we haven't. Certainly the people haven't recovered. And I think that there is a desire to maybe, you know, reconfigure the globe so that the economic system will be saved. One, through war, but also through more penetration of countries and their resources, and also by preventing countries like Russia and China, for example, from taking their own share of the world's resources. I mean, in essence, I think the U.S. wants to engage in more extreme imperialist activity, for lack of a better term. I know that's not a term people like, imperialism. We're an empire that we don't admit it to ourselves. But I think the U.S. is very much bent on preventing any state from competing with the U.S. anywhere in the globe, even on the periphery of these other states. You know, that Russia's not even allowed to compete with the U.S. on its own borders. China's not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the South China Sea, even though it's called the South China Sea. Iran is not allowed to compete with the U.S. in the Persian Gulf. You know, Persia's not allowed to control the Persian Gulf. You know, and so I think this explains a lot of what's happening, that the U.S. really, I think if one were objective about it, is at war with pretty much the whole world at this point. And you see, you know, sanctions regime after sanction regime being leveled against all sorts of countries now, military threats against all sorts of countries. It's a very dangerous situation, but it seems to be dangerous by design, really.
You write that the vilification of Russia and the Russian president constitutes a new Cold War. What about the old Cold War? You write extensively about the original Cold War against the USSR. When did the Cold War against the USSR begin, and who initiated it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think the Cold War with a capital C and a capital W started right after World War II. I believe, as other writers like William Bloom, who I really respect, believe that the opening shots of the first Cold War was the U.S.'s atomic atom bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that those were not aimed at Japan, who was in fact trying to surrender to the U.S. despite what we've been told in history books, but it was a signal more to the Soviet Union that we had these weapons, and it was a signal for the Soviet Union to keep in line. And I think that was the opening shot of the Cold War. Again, just as World War II is ending, and we were allies, obviously, with the Soviet Union during World War II. And so we wasted no time in beginning hostilities with them. And again, of course, very quickly, we begin hostilities in the Korean Peninsula as well. In 1948, though again, we're told 1950, but really in 1948, we start to help Japan and pro Japanese forces in Korea try to reestablish Japanese colonial rule in Korea, and this leads to the conflict there. And so I think we can trace the Cold War, as we think about it, back to that point. But we can even go farther back than that. I mean, I think folks have to remember that the U.S. and a number of other capitalist countries invaded the Soviet Union right after the revolution. The revolution being, of course, in October of 1917. By the old calendar, by the new calendar, was November 7th, 1917. A number of capitalist countries, including the United States, invaded Russia in 1918 to try to strangle the revolution in its crib. And so one could trace the Cold War even as far back as 1918. So this has been going on for quite some time. But again, the whole raison d'etre, or what we were told was the raison d'etre of the Cold War, was to fight communism. And so the Russians thought that if they would give up socialism, that the U.S. and the West would welcome them back into the West with open arms. And that never happened. The U.S. seemed to never want peace with Russia, whether they were socialist or communist or capitalist. And the Russians learned that the hard way after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. They were never admitted back into the community of nations. And I think that the U.S. bears great responsibility for that, if not sole responsibility for that fact. And I think we need to go back and look at that history and the U.S.'s own role in continuing hostilities with Russia when that original casus belli of communism went away.
You write that the U.S. forced the worst economic policies on the Russians, encircled Russia with troops and military bases after promising not to, and now the U.S. resents them for having their own sovereignty. What kind of economic shape is Russia in today?
Well, first of all, just to go over those facts, when the Cold War was ending and Gorbachev and Reagan agreed to the reunification of Germany, which was a big deal for Russia, of course, because Russia had lost about 27 million people to the Germans during World War II. Gorbachev agreed to the reunification of Germany in return for the promise, and Secretary of State James Baker made this promise explicitly, that NATO would not move one inch east of Germany. In fact, as you noted, NATO very quickly moved eastward and is now up to the border of Russia. And so Russia is, in fact, surrounded by NATO in a way that the U.S. is not surrounded by any Russian or pro-Russian troops in this hemisphere. And meanwhile, as you say, during the Yeltsin years, Bill Clinton and his cabal, for lack of a better word, imposed upon Russia very draconian neoliberal policies, which devastated that country. A couple million people died of preventable illnesses because of those economic policies. And it's taken a long time for Russia to get back on its feet since then. It is starting to get back on its feet. Again, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the life expectancy in Russia went down to the low 50s from somewhere in the range of the 70s during the height of the Soviet Union. It is now going back up to the low 70s under Putin. And so while they have their problems, certainly, under Putin, things have gotten better economically. And again, as Stephen F. Cohen, who I often cite, I really respect him. He was friends with Gorbachev, an advisor to Gorbachev. He's been a Russian expert for many years. He said it's really Putin's having gotten the bear back on its feet that galls the United States more than anything. And he has done that, you know, and whatever you say about the guy, he has done that. And he has about 80% approval rating in Russia as a result. And again, this is apparently unacceptable to the U.S.
You know, one shocking statement that you made in your book that I had no idea of is that you write that presently the GDP of the Russian Federation is really about the equivalent of Portugal or Spain. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, again, their economy shrunk after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The collapse of the Soviet Union in many ways was tragic. I say that in my book. I don't apologize for saying that. And by the way, a lot of Reaganites agree with me on that, Paul Craig Roberts amongst them. And there was a lot of devastation. And again, they are getting back on their feet. But yeah, they're not anywhere near where they used to be economically or militarily. And I note that in the book, and I note it now, only to say that they are not a threat to the United States. They are not even a serious competitor with the U.S. in the world, maybe at their periphery, maybe in isolated areas, but certainly not in the vast scope of world affairs. They just can't compete given the relative size of our economy and military over theirs.
Now, we spoke earlier about the accusation that the Russian Federation was hacking into DNC email, et cetera, to try and influence the election of Donald Trump. What can you tell us about Yeltsin's failing 1996 presidential campaign? Did the U.S. meddle in that election?
Yes. And again, we need only look at Time Magazine's cover story after Yeltsin's victory, which explains a lot of this, how Politico's associated with Bill Clinton went into Russia to salvage Yeltsin's campaign, because Bill Clinton was very dead set on Yeltsin winning the 1996 election. And as we now know, according to Dick Morris, who worked for Bill Clinton, he recently said that Bill Clinton himself personally helped Yeltsin with his campaign, talked to him at times almost daily to advise him as to how to run his campaign in great detail. And again, he had at least these three campaign advisors associated with Clinton who went to Russia with $250,000, and they helped Yeltsin with his campaign at a time when his approval rating was at about 6%. And they helped Yeltsin in conducting dirty tricks, which helped him win the election. Although even with that said, Dmitry Medvedev has said that Yeltsin really didn't win the election. It was stolen from the Communist Party, which arguably still won the election. But nonetheless, Yeltsin, by hook or by crook, and with the help of Clinton and his friends, managed to at least claim victory, and he continued to be president, again, with amazing help from Clinton and his campaign aides.
I'm speaking with human rights attorney and author Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, Boris Yeltsin, as president of the Russian Federation, oversaw, of course, the selling off of Russian state property, the privatization of it, the rise of the oligarchs. As you have pointed out, Bill Clinton was a big supporter. The U.S. was a big supporter of Yeltsin. And you mentioned in your book the Duma catastrophe. What was the Duma catastrophe?
Yeah, and I actually recall this happening at the time. It's a pretty incredible thing. So Yeltsin, again, who was not popular, who was imposing austerity measures on his own people, which were devastating to the people, though very popular with folks here in the United States, particularly Bill Clinton. At some point, there is a huge pushback against Yeltsin's economic policies by the Communist Party, which to this day is, I believe, still the largest party in Russia. And they ended up sitting in the White House. At that time, the Duma or the parliament was housed in what was called the White House. And they had a sit-in there to protest Yeltsin, and they were very popular in the sit-in because people were very unhappy with the economic policies. And Yeltsin tried to starve them out, cut off the electricity and water to the place. They still wouldn't leave, and so he started shelling his own parliamentary building, again, at that time the White House. It is unknown how many people died during that attack, but it's easily a couple hundred and could be a couple thousand people. And it's a time, and I remember this very vividly. At the time, the Western media applauded Yeltsin for shelling his own parliament. And I mentioned in the book, I said, you know, this was like a Tiananmen Square type operation that Yeltsin conducted, but it just, you know, in this case, the West was rooting for the tanks. And I imagine the Russian people don't forget that too easily. And I think Americans need to, when we think about these allegations against Putin and Russia in terms of alleged election meddling, even if you assume the worst in terms of the allegations, they pale in comparison to the type of meddling the U.S. was doing at that time. So, in any case.
You write about the demodernization and economic collapse after the dissolution of the USSR, approximately 1992 to 1998, under Boris Yeltsin and supported by Bill Clinton. Now, another thing that Boris Yeltsin did after this Duma catastrophe or the shelling of their own legislature, he put in something called the Law on the Federal Security Service, FSB. And didn't these amount to police state measures?
Yes. Again, he, because of his incredible unpopularity, he began to reestablish what some human rights groups said, essentially the Soviet-type security system, which the U.S. had always been critical of as a repressive state apparatus. Well, he began to reestablish that to keep himself in control. And so, again, when we talk about Putin's alleged authoritarianism, whatever Putin is, we have to trace back to those days under Yeltsin, who begins to recreate the security state in Russia that Putin ends up inheriting. But again, when Yeltsin was running that security state, you know, in ways that benefited the West by allowing this selling off of Russia's industries, no one cared. Now all of a sudden we care about democracy in Russia, though, you know, or at least we claim to.
In what ways did the Cold War benefit the United States and its foreign interventionist policies? Has the U.S. been able to intervene more easily internationally by using the Cold War with the USSR as a pretext?
Yes, well, and I think it was very effective. You know, anytime the U.S. wanted to intervene in another country, like Nicaragua, I talk about Nicaragua for me is a very I have a lot of emotion around it. I like a lot of folks, I visited Nicaragua during the Contra War that the U.S. supported. You know, here's a very poor country at that time, still is. Had not even 3 million people, and the U.S. under Ronald Reagan supported this very brutal terrorist war against Nicaragua. And that's what it was. It was a terrorist war. The Contras were terrorists. And, of course, it justified it on the basis of the Soviet threat. Well, there was no Soviet threat in Nicaragua. Never was, never will be. The Sandinistas, again, whatever you say about them, were an indigenous organization that overthrew a U.S.-backed dictator in Anastasio Somoza. They came to power through a guerrilla war that they themselves fought. They didn't have Russian troops who helped them. And again, the U.S.'s war against Nicaragua was not about fighting communism. It was about reestablishing a dictatorship that the U.S. had supported for decades and had actually installed. And but yeah, every time we wanted to attack another country in order to maintain our economic dominance over the world, we would always blame the Soviet Union, whether they had anything to do with that country or not. And many times they had nothing to do with it. Sometimes they would come in later because the country, under huge duress, would call for Soviet assistance. But the war would begin before the Soviets had anything to do with it. And, you know, one great example, and this should be remembered by people if they ever knew it, is Afghanistan. You know, the myth around Afghanistan is that the U.S. supported the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, in order to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion. In fact, that is not true. We now know from Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, that the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen before the Soviet Union invaded. And in fact, in order to precipitate a Soviet invasion, to give the Soviet Union their Vietnam. That was Brzezinski's words. And again, we justified it on the basis, oh, we have to fight the Soviet invasion. Well, that hadn't even happened yet. And so we see time and again, not only us being lied into nearly every war we've ever fought, but in the case of the Cold War, effectively being lied to by saying that we were fighting the Soviet Union.
You write extensively about U.S. interventions, overthrows of governments, and invasions since the beginning of the Cold War. You traveled to two Central and South American countries, Nicaragua and Colombia, and you've touched on Nicaragua. What were your experiences in these two countries?
Well, again, in Nicaragua, which was really, my experience there really changed my view of the world and the U.S. role in it. And I went there in 1987 during the height of the Contra War, spent time in a war zone there. And I went with the basic belief that whatever the U.S.'s faults, that it was essentially a force for good in the world, even if we erred once in a while. And I left not believing that anymore. I really believed we were quite the opposite, that we were a bully that was willing to wage this war against a people in one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere in retaliation for them overthrowing a U.S. dictatorship. That is to say that I came to the conclusion that far from defending democracy and freedom around the world, the U.S. was trying to stop it. And I think if you look at U.S. history, you will see the U.S. do that time and again. And I was very moved by the Nicaraguans' tenacity, by their dignity in defending themselves against, obviously, a much more formidable force, the United States, and frankly, coming out victorious, which is pretty incredible. In Colombia, which I still visit quite often, and I've been going there since 1999, I again see U.S. intervention very, very prominent there. The U.S. has been intervening very directly in Colombia for many decades, certainly since 1962 and even before, and in very destructive ways, supporting a very repressive military, which itself supports paramilitaries, death squads, that the U.S. actually helped to create back in the 1960s. And again, when folks talk about Venezuela and things happening there, I'm always amazed how they ignore the much greater human rights crisis in that neighboring Colombia, where you have thousands of trade union leaders who've been killed and human rights leaders killed, indigenous leaders killed. Colombia has 7 million internally displaced people. the largest internally displaced population on Earth, even larger than Syria. And these are folks displaced largely by forces that the U.S. supports, either directly or indirectly. And yet, when was the last time you heard about that? For me, Colombia represents everything that's frankly wrong with not only U.S. foreign policy, but how it's covered in the press. Every time something bad happens in Venezuela, we hear about it. And many times, in fact, how bad things are tend to be exaggerated in our press. Meanwhile, the terrible things that happen in Colombia, which I think has the worst human rights in the hemisphere, and many people agree with me, those things are ignored. And for me, that reality has made me very skeptical about what I hear or read in the news about what the U.S. is doing around the world.
I'm speaking with human rights attorney and author Dan Kovalik. Today's show, Russiagate, scapegoating Russia to justify endless war. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to quote from your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Quote, while the dreaded Putin has been president on and off since 1999, he did not stray beyond the old Soviet borders, and really not all that far until nearly the end of 2015. And there, of course, you're referring to Syria. During that same time, the U.S. has itself militarily intervened in Syria, both covertly and overtly, through major bombing raids, engaged in a major bombing campaign of Serbia, very close to Russia, overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, invaded Afghanistan, which it has yet to leave, invaded Iraq, which it has yet to leave, engaged in what it termed anti-terrorist operations in Georgia on the border of Russia, Djibouti, Kenya, Ethiopia, Yemen, and Eritrea, engaged in military actions in Somalia, which ended up destabilizing that country for years to come, supported the coup against the democratic government of Zelaya in Honduras, and participated in the NATO invasion and dismantling of Libya, end quote. And here you're only referring to U.S. actions since 1999. How does this fit with the accusations of Russian expansionism?
I think Russian claims of Russian expansionism pale in comparison. I mean, I'm just always amazed when people say, hey, well, what about Putin in Ukraine? What about Putin in Syria? And pretty much the list ends there, right there, right? And look at all the countries that we've invaded. And by the way, these were all wars of choice. They weren't necessary. And the Physicians for Social Responsibility just released a study saying that in the U.S. wars in the Middle East since September 11th, 2001, the U.S. has killed up to about 2 million people in the Middle East. If we go back to since 1990, 4 million people. 4 million people. And again, the idea that people are exercised about what Putin might be doing in the east part of Ukraine or in Syria, and yet seem utterly unconcerned about what the U.S. is doing throughout the globe, including, by the way, in Yemen right now. You know, Yemen has the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth. Millions of people will die there. Millions. This is according to the United Nations. Through starvation, through disease, because of a war that Saudi Arabia most prominently is fighting against Yemen, but with very critical support from the United States, including weaponry, logistical support, the mid-air refueling of its planes, which then go and bomb civilians in Yemen. Millions of people will die because of that war, which I would say if you asked 1 in 10,000 people, you'd be lucky to have one who even knew what was happening. And if they did, they wouldn't be able to explain what was happening there. Yet the press seems very unconcerned about that. Again, meanwhile, focusing on the couple conflicts that Putin may be involved in. And I just think it's that sort of disproportionate and frankly unfair media portrayals of what you know, the U.S. and Russia are doing in the world relative to each other that I just find absolutely galling and confounding that they're able to get away with it, that people seem to buy it. They seem to have been convinced that, well, there's a Russian under every bed, and meanwhile seem unconcerned about what the U.S. is doing around the globe.
It's also significant that when a story, let's say Russiagate, is repeatedly broadcast, that it crowds out other important news. And now you have just mentioned the war in Yemen. You point out that the war in Yemen is actually in its third year, and that this war began under Obama. What kind of support is the U.S. supplying to the Saudis for the attack on Yemen? And did the Clinton Foundation have any connection with the war in Yemen?
Well, yes. As I note in the book, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, approved a major sale of fighter jets to Saudi Arabia just after the Clinton Foundation received a huge a donation from Saudi Arabia, millions of dollars. Was that a quid pro quo? I don't know. But certainly there was the appearance of impropriety there that she was approving this weapon sale after her foundation received a huge donation from Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, the U.S. has provided, in addition to such fighter jets, billions of dollars of military hardware, cluster bombs, which are being used in Yemen, again, helping Saudi Arabia find targets to bomb in Yemen. They're refueling the bombing planes midair, and also have helped with the Saudi blockade against Yemen, which, again, is starving out the people there. Again, according to the UN, 7 million people at least are on the verge of starvation. Meanwhile, almost 500,000 people are now suffering from cholera, again, all because of this war and this blockade, which the U.S. is intimately involved with. And again, this began under Obama, Saint Obama, that everyone now looks back to so wistfully. And I understand why. I mean, obviously, Trump is a pretty reprehensible guy. But Obama did very reprehensible things, including in Yemen, including in Libya, which, by the way, in Libya, post-invasion, which, again, was led by Obama and spurred on by Hillary Clinton, there are now slaves being publicly sold on the streets of Libya. This is a fact. You can look it up. This makes the mainstream press once in a while. This was directly the result of that invasion that Obama was a key part of. And, again, there's this weird thing in the U.S., which basically, if I'm a Democrat and a Democratic president does these horrible things, I don't care. I mean, that just seems to be a common reaction. But actually, the opposite isn't necessarily true. That is to say, very curiously, while people find much to criticize about Trump, and there is much to criticize, but the one time he got a bump in his ratings, approval ratings, is after he launched 59 Tomahawk missiles against Syria earlier this year in response to an alleged chemical attack in Syria. It appears that on matters of war and peace, sadly, the American public is largely indifferent to it. Even though the things folks want, you know, better health care, bigger social safety net, jobs, etc., better infrastructure, those things are being sacrificed by the U.S., which has decided instead to spend trillions of dollars on wars, which have no benefit to the average American person. Under Obama, by the way, Obama began a $1 trillion modernization of the U.S.'s nuclear weapon stockpile, and that's continued under Trump. That modernization, which according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, appears designed and intended to give the U.S. first strike capability, nuclear capability against Russia. I don't see anyone pushing the panic button about that. But it seems like if you were going to panic about anything, it would be about the possibility of a nuclear war.
You include in your book the plot to scapegoat Russia. A quote from Russian President Vladimir Putin, quote, "Anyone who doesn't regret the passing of the Soviet Union has no heart. Anyone who wants it restored has no brains," end quote. The vast majority of Soviet citizens wanted to preserve the Soviet Union. Why do you think this is, and how has the collapse of the Soviet Union affected the working class worldwide?
Well, I mean, they wanted the continuation, and a referendum that was held in 1991 across the Soviet Union showed about 78% for the support of the Soviet Union, the continuation of the Soviet Union. They supported it because, frankly, the Soviet Union, for all of its faults, brought a good standard of living to the people of the Soviet Union, including Russia. It managed to defeat Nazi Germany, and it brought great pride to the people, again, particularly of Russia, which obviously was the dominant country in the Soviet Union. And the collapse has not brought about the peace and prosperity that the Russians were promised or that any of the rest of us were. You know, once the Soviet Union collapsed and China, as a result, gave up really on its design for socialism, or at least put it off for some time, this ends up opening huge markets for the West. And what happened was that the U.S. started massively offshoring its labor, causing devastation to this country in terms of jobs and good jobs. And the other thing the Soviet Union did, it did create a certain amount of balance in the world, which frankly is greatly needed at this time.
Now, wasn't Russia and then later the USSR excellent allies of the United States in both world wars?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, in World War II, even to say they were good allies really understates what they were. I mean, folks have to remember the U.S. didn't enter the European theater in a serious way in World War II till 1944. You know, really, they kind of held back until the Russians had pretty much came close to defeating Hitler. You know, they really bore the brunt of the war in Europe. And I think the world owes Russia debt for that effort. And they lost 27 million people in the process. And now, by the way, there's a huge revisionism that's been happening for years where now the U.S. claims, oh, we won the war and Britain won the war. Well, again, I'm not saying that they didn't play a role. But now folks are trying to deny the substantial role that the Russia had in winning the war. And it's just – it's that sort of revisionism, which is crucial, by the way, to allowing us to continue to vilify Russia, because if folks, you know, remember the truth that Russia was so critical in defeating Nazism, it's much harder to claim that Putin is the equivalent to Hitler, for example, which Hillary Clinton has claimed. People are even trying to claim that Putin's somehow behind, you know, the alt-right in the U.S. and the alt-right demonstrations in Charlottesville, when in fact Russia just recently sponsored a anti-fascist resolution in the U.N., which the U.S. voted against. But again, if you don't remember what happened during World War II and which country fought on which side, it's easier to be taken in by this sort of propaganda.
In your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia, you quote George Kennan, State Department Director of Policy Planning in 1948, quote, "Were the Soviet Union to sink tomorrow under the waters of the ocean, the American military-industrial establishment would have to go on substantially unchanged until some other adversary could be invented." Why do you think this is so?
Well, again, because certainly since World War II, the U.S. economy has been based on the military-industrial complex, continuous warfare. And if you don't have enemies, you can't have wars. And so the U.S. has constantly been in search for enemies. Again, when the Soviet Union collapsed, It's a little difficult to claim it needed to fight Russia, so it came up, you know, with other justifications for war, fighting drugs, fighting terrorism, when in fact the U.S. was in some ways promoting drugs and terrorism. But yeah, the U.S. needs its scapegoats and it needs its enemies to continue justifying spending more on its military than what the next nine countries or so combined. No one would put up with that if they thought there wasn't a reason for it. But people do put up with it, largely because they, I guess, buy that countries like Russia truly are a threat to the United States. And that's why I wrote the book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, to argue the fact that Russia is not an enemy and that this is being really foisted on us to justify conflicts that are not in our benefit.
Dan Kovalik, thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you in person on Thursday, September 7th in Berkeley.
Thank you, Bonnie. And I appreciate the opportunity for this interview. I enjoyed it.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dan Kovalik. Today's show has been Russiagate, Scapegoating Russia to Justify Endless War. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights lawyer. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik is the featured speaker Thursday, September 7th at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, starting at 7:30 p.m. This event is part of the KPFA Speakers Series. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind?
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I hope that you enjoyed today's show with Dan Kovalik. He's going to be speaking tomorrow night. That's Thursday the 7th. At St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue, Berkeley. His new book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, is a very important book. So this is a very important event. I'm going to be there, and I hope you will be too. And don't forget, next Monday, September 11th, is our annual 9/11 Film Festival. Doors open at 2 o'clock. Program at 3. Our evening keynote speaker is Dr. William Pepper, author of Orders to Kill, his first book on Dr. Martin Luther King, his second book, An Act of State, his most recent book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. In person, Dr. William Pepper. That's Monday night at the 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. It will be live streamed by NoLiesRadio.org. They are a Pacifica affiliate. That's NoLiesRadio.org. Dr. Kevin Barrett, Dr. Tony Hall are going to be at the film festival in person. We'll be tabling in the lobby, and we, all of us, look so forward to seeing all of you, which so many of you I only get to see once a year. So thank you very much.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Lynn Gurry returns with part two of her excellent reading of Escaping the Matrix. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let me start off by putting the Matrix in context and summarizing last week's part of the story. The Matrix was a fairly bad movie, in mine humble opinion, released in 1999. Keanu Reeves played the 20-something guy, Neo, who starts exploring how the real world really works. In fact, I forget how the real world actually does work in the movie, but it involves a lot of darkness and repression and violence, just like ours. In the movie, very few people have any inkling of what the real world is really like. People are actually held in suspended animation and fed a steady stream of artificial perceptions and artificial experiences. In this phony artificial world, in the world of the Matrix, things go pretty smoothly and the population stays pretty content. As I said, this movie is not a landmark of cinematic art, but its central trope is excellent: the contrast of illusion versus reality, the false impression of popular freedom and power versus the actual system's control of the unaware, unwitting people. This idea goes way back, most famously to a section of Plato's Republic. Reality versus illusion, and which is which? It's a powerful trope. It rings true to many of our own experiences, and we find it in literature and rhetoric and art century after century. For example, today the extreme right wing likes to describe the mass of Americans as sheeple, sheep people, totally unaware of how they are being deceived and manipulated, brainwashed by the evil foes of individual freedom. In fact, I think the right wing is more or less correct. The extreme right and I just disagree about who the evil mastermind behind the deception is. For the far right, the villains are the socialists, communists, democrats, and such, led by the Pope of Rome, assisted by the Masonic Order, Satan, the Trilateral Commission, and Barack H. Obama. For me and some others on the left, the evil masterminds are instead the board of directors of the Fortune 500, plus their servants at the World Bank, the Pentagon, and whomever they have chosen to be president of the United States at the moment. Okay, I'll give the right credit for the Trilateral Commission. Good call there. Your list of scoundrels may vary. In the year 2000, a progressive thinker named Richard K. Moore published a nice essay titled Escaping the Matrix. Moore makes the Matrix movie a metaphor for the world today. For Moore, the evil masterminds of our world are the billionaire capitalist ownership class. Moore traces the changing relationships of the global economy, the nation-state, empire and imperialism, and the capitalists who now run the show. We heard the first half last week. Moore discussed how, in the past, the capitalist elite supported a strong, powerful state engaged in imperialism abroad. Imperialism enriched the capitalists at home at the expense of the colonized people on the periphery. The capitalists got much richer, and the citizens at the heart of the empire got a little more prosperous. But then the relationship of the powers began to change. By now, aided by neoliberal economic policies, the capitalist elite has gotten stronger than the state and is seeking to weaken the state further, apart from the state's military, which the capitalist elite now controls. The several so-called free trade agreements are essentially laws that stop the state from doing anything that would interfere with the capitalists' corporate profits. The real imperial core now is no longer the nation-state, but the transnational capitalist elite themselves. The elite is now plundering the economy of what used to be the imperial core, the same way they had earlier plundered the economies of India and Africa. On to today's segment. Plundering the former core makes its citizens poorer and resentful, so the elite institutes ever more repressive measures to control the restless population. For example, neutralizing the Bill of Rights, and abolishing welfare and Social Security, and by fostering divisiveness at home. Divide and rule. Lynn Gary read the first half of Moore's essay last week. Here she is with part two of Richard K. Moore's essay from 2000, Escaping the Matrix.
Globalization and World Government. The essential bond between capitalism and nationalism was broken in 1945, but it took some time for elite planners to recognize this new condition and to begin bringing the world system into alignment with it. The strong Western nation-state had been the bulwark of capitalism for centuries, and initial post-war policies were based on the assumption that this would continue indefinitely. The Bretton Woods financial system, the IMF, World Bank, and a system of fixed exchange rates among major currencies was set up to stabilize national economies, and popular prosperity was encouraged to provide political stability. Neoliberalism in the U.S. and Britain represented the first serious break with this policy framework and brought the first visible signs of the fission of the nation-capital bond. The neoliberal project was economically profitable in the U.S. and Britain, and the public accepted the matrix economic mythology. Meanwhile, the integrated global economy gave rise to a new generation of transnational corporations, and corporate leaders began to realize that corporate growth was not dependent on a strong core nation state. Indeed, Western nations, with their environmental laws, consumer protection measures, and other forms of regulatory interference, were a burden on corporate growth. Having been successfully field-tested in the two oldest, quote-unquote, democracies, the neoliberal project moved onto the global stage. The Bretton Woods system of fixed rates of currency exchange was weakened, and the international financial system became destabilizing instead of stabilizing for national economies. The radical free trade project was launched, leading eventually to the World Trade Organization. The fission that had begun in 1945 was finally manifesting as an explosive change in the world system. The objective of neoliberal free trade treaties is to remove all political controls over domestic and international trade and commerce. Corporations have free rein to maximize profits, heedless of environmental consequences and safety risks. Instead of governments regulating corporations, the WTO now sets rules for governments, telling them what kind of beef they must import, whether or not they can ban asbestos, and what additives they must permit in petroleum products. So far, in every case where the WTO has been asked to review a health, safety, or environmental regulation, the regulation has been overturned. Most of the world has been turned into a periphery. The imperial core has boiled down to the capitalist elite themselves, represented by their bureaucratic, unrepresentative WTO world government. The burden of accelerated imperialism falls hardest outside the West, where loans are used as a lever by the IMF to compel debtor nations such as Rwanda and South Korea to accept suicidal, quote, reform packages. In the 1800s, genocide was employed to clear North America and Australia of their native populations, creating room for growth. Today, A similar program of genocide has apparently been unleashed against sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF destroys the economies. The CIA trains militias and stirs up tribal conflicts. And the West sells weapons to all sides. Famine and genocidal civil wars are the predictable and inevitable result. Meanwhile, AIDS runs rampant while the WTO and the U.S. government use trade laws to prevent medicines from reaching the victims. As in the past, Western military force will be required to control the non-Western periphery and make adjustments to local political arrangements when considered necessary by elite planners. The Pentagon continues to provide the primary policing power, with NATO playing an ever-increasing role. Resentment against the West and against neoliberalism is growing in the Third World, and the frequency of military interventions is bound to increase. All of this needs to be made acceptable to Western minds, adding a new dimension to the Matrix. In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes. Bill Clinton made it explicit with his Clinton Doctrine, in which, as quoted in the Washington Post, he solemnly promised, quote, "If somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background, or their religion, and it is within our power to stop it, we will stop it," close quote. This matrix fabrication is very effective indeed. Who opposes prevention of genocide? Only outside the matrix does one see that genocide is caused by the West in the first place, and that the worst cases of genocide are continuing, that assistance usually makes things worse, as in the Balkans, and that Clinton's handy doctrine enables him to intervene when and where he chooses, since dictators and the stirring of ethnic rivalries are standard tools in managing the periphery. A U.S. president can always find, quote, innocent civilians, wherever elite plans call for an intervention. In Matrix reality, globalization is not a project, but rather the inevitable result of beneficial market forces. Genocide in Africa is no fault of the West, but is due to ancient tribal rivalries. Every measure demanded by globalization is referred to as reform. The word is never used with irony. Democracy and reform are frequently used together, always leaving the subtle impression that one has something to do with the other. The illusion is presented that all economic boats are rising, and if yours isn't, it must be your own fault. You aren't competitive enough. Economic failures are explained away as temporary adjustments, or else the victim, as in South Korea or Russia, is blamed for not being sufficiently neoliberal. Investor confidence is referred to with the same awe and reverence that earlier societies might have expressed towards the will of the gods. The Western quality of life continues to decline, while the WTO establishes legal precedents ensuring that its authority will not be challenged when its decisions become more draconian. Things will get much worse in the West. This was anticipated in elite circles when the neoliberal project was still on the drawing board, as is illustrated in Samuel Huntington's The Crisis of Democracy report discussed earlier. The management of discontented societies. The post-war years, especially in the United States, were characterized by consensus politics. Most people shared a common understanding of how society worked and generally approved of how things were going. Prosperity was real, and the Matrix version of reality was reassuring. Most people believed in it. Those beliefs became a shared consensus, and the government could then carry out its plans as intended, responding to the programmed public will. The excess democracy of the 1960s and 1970s attacked this shared consensus from below, and neoliberal planners decided from above that ongoing consensus wasn't worth paying for. They accepted that segments of society would persist in disbelieving various parts of the matrix. Activism and protest were to be expected. New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent, as neoliberalism gradually tightened the economic screws. Such means of control were identified and have since been largely implemented, particularly in the United States. In many ways, America sets the pace of globalization. Innovations can often be observed there before they occur elsewhere. This is particularly true in the case of social control techniques. The most obvious means of social control in a discontented society is a strong, semi-militarized police force. Most of the periphery had been managed by such means for centuries. This was obvious to elite planners in the West, was adopted as policy, and has now been largely implemented. Urban and suburban ghettos, where the adverse consequences of neoliberalism are currently most concentrated, have literally become occupied territories where police beatings and unjustified shootings are commonplace. So that the beefed-up police force could maintain control in conditions of mass unrest, elite planners also realized that much of the Bill of Rights would need to be neutralized. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. Let me say that again. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. The rights neutralization project has been largely implemented, as exemplified by armed midnight raids, outrageous search and seizure practices, overly broad conspiracy laws, wholesale invasion of privacy, massive incarceration, and the rise of prison slave labor. The Rubicon has been crossed. The techniques of oppression, long common in the empire's periphery, are being imported to the core. In The Matrix, the genre of the TV or movie police drama has served to create a reality in which rights are a joke, the accused are despicable sociopaths, and no criminal is ever brought to justice until some noble cop or prosecutor bends the rules a bit. Government officials bolster the construct by declaring wars on crime and drugs, and noble cops are fighting a war out there in the streets. And you can't win a war without using your enemy's dirty tricks. The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied. In this way, the American public has been led to accept the means of its own suppression. The mechanisms of the police state are in place. They will be used when necessary, as we see in ghettos and skyrocketing prison populations, as we saw on the streets of Seattle and Washington, D.C. during recent anti-WTO demonstrations, and as is suggested by executive orders that enable the president to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law whenever he deems it necessary. But raw force is only the last line of defense for the elite regime. Neoliberal planners introduced more subtle defenses into the matrix. Looking at these will bring us back to our discussion of the left and right. Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control, standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized, and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. In the prosperous post-war years, consensus politics served to manage the population. Under neoliberalism, programmed factionalism has become the frontline defense, the matrix version of divide and rule. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. They have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. In the U.S., that weapon has been used to promote censorship on the Internet, to attack the women's movement, to support repressive legislation, and generally to bolster the ranks of what is called in the Matrix the right wing. In the Matrix, the various factions believe that their competition with each other is the process that determines society's political agenda. Politicians want votes, and hence the biggest and best organized factions should have the most influence, and their agendas should get the most political attention. In reality, there is only one significant political agenda these days: the maximization of capital growth through the dismantling of society, the continuing implementation of neoliberalism, and the management of empire. Clinton's liberal rhetoric and his playing around with health care and gay rights are not the result of liberal pressure. They are rather the means by which Clinton is sold to liberal voters, so that he can proceed with real business, getting NAFTA through Congress, promoting the WTO, giving away the public airwaves, justifying military interventions, and so forth. Issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I repeat, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Escaping the Matrix. The Matrix cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Under the onslaught of globalization, the glitches are becoming ever more difficult to conceal, as earlier with the Vietnam War. November's anti-establishment demonstrations in Seattle, the largest in decades, were aimed directly at globalization and the WTO. Even more important, Seattle saw the coming together of factions that the Matrix had programmed to fight one another, such as left-leaning environmentalists and socially conservative union members. Seattle represented the tip of an iceberg. A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry, scorching day. The establishment has been expecting such a movement and has a variety of defenses at its command, including those used effectively against the movements of the 1960s and 1970s. In order to prevail against what seems like overwhelming odds, the movement must escape entirely from the matrix, and it must bring the rest of society with it. As long as the matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. The whole truth must be faced. Globalization is centralized tyranny. Capitalism has outlasted its sell-by date. Matrix democracy is elite rule, and market forces are imperialism. Left and right are enemies only in the matrix. In reality, we are all in this together, and each of us has a contribution to make toward a better world. Marx may have failed as a social visionary, but he had capitalism figured out. It is based not on productivity or social benefit, but on the pursuit of capital growth through exploiting everything in its path. The job of elite planners is to create new spaces for capital to grow in. Competitive imperialism provided growth for centuries. Collective imperialism was invented when still more growth was needed, and then neoliberalism took over. Like a cancer, capitalism consumes its host and is never satisfied. The capital pool must always grow more and more forever, until the host dies or capitalism is replaced. The Matrix equates capitalism with free enterprise and defines centralized state planning socialism as the only alternative to capitalism. In reality, capitalism didn't amount to much of a force until the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution of the late 1700s, and we certainly cannot characterize all prior societies as socialist. Free enterprise, private property, commerce, banking, international trade, economic specialization, all of these had existed for millennia before capitalism. Capitalism claims credit for modern prosperity, but credit would be better given to developments in science and technology. Before capitalism, Western nations were generally run by aristocratic classes. The aristocratic attitude toward wealth focused on management and maintenance. With capitalism, the focus is always on growth and development. Whatever one has is but the seeds to build a still greater fortune. In fact, there are infinite alternatives to capitalism, and different societies can choose different systems once they are free to do so. As Morpheus put it, outside the Matrix, everything is possible. And there are no limits. The Matrix defines democracy as competitive party politics because that is a game wealthy elites have long since learned to corrupt and manipulate. Even in the days of the Roman Republic, the techniques were well understood. Real-world democracy is possible only if the people themselves participate in setting society's direction. An elected official can only truly represent a constituency after that constituency has worked out its positions, from the local to the global, on the issues of the day. For that to happen, the interests of different societal factions must be harmonized through interaction and discussion. Collaboration, not competition, is what leads to effective harmonization. In order for the movement to end elite rule and establish livable societies to succeed, it will need to evolve a democratic process and to use that process to develop a program of consensus reform that harmonizes the interests of its constituencies. In order to be politically victorious, it will need to reach out to all segments of society and become a majority movement. By such means, the democratic process of the movement can become the democratic process of a newly empowered civil society. There is no adequate theory of democracy at present, though there is much to be learned from history and from theory. The movement will need to develop a democratic process as it goes along, and that objective must be pursued as diligently as victory itself. Otherwise, some new tyranny will eventually replace the old.
Lynn Gurry with a beautiful reading of Richard K. Moore's 2000 essay, Escaping the Matrix. Lynn read it in 2002 on the radio show she produced, Unwelcome Guests. That's still in business under new management at unwelcomeguests.net. And we can be found at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum, and please come back again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
I'm joined on the show today by Dr. Graham McQueen. Graham McQueen was the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a PhD in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He's the author of the book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which came out in 2014, and he was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. And he's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. And he joins me today to discuss an article he recently published on some recent polls taken in the United Kingdom. Graham McQueen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's always great to talk to you.
Yes, and you recently published an article on the great website globalresearch.ca called 9/11 Truth, British Muslims Overwhelmingly Reject the Official 9/11 Story. Could you tell us who put on that poll, a little bit about it?
Sure. The poll itself was published just this last December 2016, and I kind of chanced upon it when I was doing research for a different article. So I read it and was quite fascinated both by the poll results and by the way the poll was interpreted. So that's why I wrote the article. The group that sponsored the poll is called Policy Exchange. It's a think tank in Britain. We can euphemistically say it's a conservative think tank, not to say right wing. The current chair of the Board of Trustees of Policy Exchange is David Frum, who is a well-known neoconservative, co-author of a book with Richard Perle, and therefore very much in that circle of what we often call neocons. The think tank Policy Exchange has a special relationship with the Conservative Party in the UK, is considered important, is even sometimes thought of as a kind of breeding ground for young conservative intellectuals and politicians in the UK. So it's interesting that they would be the ones to carry out a big poll, and they didn't actually carry it out. They delegated that to ICM, which is a polling company, but they're the ones who presumably designed the original questions and who wanted to do this. And it's a large poll, seems to be decently done scientifically if you overlook the actual questions that they ask and their goals and their interpretation. About 3,000, roughly, Muslims in the UK surveyed, and they also surveyed a control group of a little over 2,000 people who were meant to represent the UK population as a whole, so they could then contrast the control group with British Muslims. So that's the gist.
Great. And David Frum, just so people know, wasn't he involved in the Bush administration in the build-up to the war and taking us to Iraq?
Yeah, Tim. I'm afraid to say he came from my country, Canada, one of our great contributions.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, his mother was a very famous, a very well-known journalist in Canada. And, of course, it's a little creepy when you think of a group that was actually described by a major Muslim organization in Britain, the Muslim Council of Britain, described Policy Exchange as, quote, an anti-Muslim organization. So think about it. You know, a party which represents the political right in the UK, which is thought of as antagonistic to Muslims by major organization of Muslims in UK, decides to carry out this detailed survey, which, you know, breaks down Muslims into different groups according to where they're living in the country and asks very detailed questions about what they believe and think and their values and so on and so forth. I mean, this is a gift, really, to British police, British intelligence. You begin to see that there is a kind of a fuzzy line, actually, between a public opinion poll and an intelligence operation. And I'm not suggesting that British intelligence was directly involved in it. I have no reason to believe they were, but I'm just saying it'd be very useful to them, even though the results clearly show that British Muslims are not the slightest bit interested in carrying out acts of violence. Quite the contrary, they are less sympathetic to acts of political violence and terrorism than the control group. So in that sense, there's nothing very interesting here in terms of targeting Muslims. Yet, despite that, Policy Exchange manages to try and find a way to interpret this poll to make Muslims look kind of scary and dangerous. Yeah, it's clearly one of their aims.
Yeah, and we've done a good job of that here in this country, too, with our media. So that seems to be the goal. So tell us a bit about the poll. What were some of the questions and how did they respond?
Oh, well, there's all sorts of questions that ask them about, you know, how do they feel about police presence and general political views, questions that are meant to test their loyalty to the UK and their strong feelings about their religion. But the question that I focused on, actually more than one, but a few of them in the poll for my article, had to do with the issue of 9/11. I thought it was interesting that a poll of British Muslims would even ask this, for one thing. But then, of course, I found the results interesting. So here was the question. Who do you think was responsible for 9/11? And the responses were, they were given five choices, by the way. First was Al-Qaeda / Muslim terrorists. Then it said Jews. Then it said the American government. Then other, and then don't know. Well, 52% said they didn't know, which is interesting. But even more interesting is the fact that 4% said Al-Qaeda or Muslim terrorists. In other words, an almost insignificant number of British Muslims believe the official narrative of 9/11, because however you want to express that official narrative, that official account of 9/11, the fact that it was supposedly carried out by Muslim terrorists is definitely an essential part of the narrative. So if you don't believe that, you really are not a believer in the official narrative. This means that here we have a population of people in the middle of the UK, in other words, in the middle of the country, which is really strongly trying to convince them, and by that I mean all major media, all parties in government, that in fact this was an act carried out by Muslim terrorists, and they almost all reject it. Now that's a strong result. That's a very interesting result. I'm not surprised that our conservative interpreters were worried about that or wanted to make something out of it. Also, we find 31% said the American government was responsible for 9/11. Mm. So, okay, there's a bit of a contrast there. 4% Muslim terrorists, 31% American government. Now, I don't want to pretend this is hugely surprising. There have been lots of polls about 9/11 before, and we can talk about that if you want.
What
the findings are from this. Yeah, well, the first thing that's obvious is that Muslims in the world, speaking in general terms here, have never bought the official story of 9/11 the way, for example, we in North America, we meaning non-Muslim, mainstream, people of various faiths and non-faiths have bought it. I mean, they just haven't. So you can find many polls on this, and they go over many different countries. This is Muslims from, but not all Arabs. For example, Turks are great disbelievers in the official narrative. They're not Arabs. People from Pakistan, they're not Arabs. Pakistanis are probably the strongest group in the world in terms of rejecting the official story, but also the Arab world. So, for example, Egypt, they don't believe it. Probably the percentage of Muslims worldwide who accept the official narrative, based on the polls we have, is not more than 17%. That's a maximum.
In your article, I noticed you have two other polls in here, a 2008 and a 2011 poll, and it looks like as time goes on, less and less Muslims believe the official story because the numbers keep going down.
That's why I gave those two results. In the 2008 one, there were 21% roughly who assigned guilt to Al-Qaeda, and by 2011 it was 17%. And we find this result generally when we're lucky enough to have the same question asked in the same words in more than one poll. Generally speaking, skepticism, as far as I can tell, has been increasing. Skepticism toward the official narrative has been increasing over time, not only with Muslims, but with others as well. So that's why I say I think it's probably no more than 17% of Muslims worldwide accept the official narrative of 9/11. And so in that sense, no surprise that Muslims are rejecting it. But still, 4% is lower as a percentage of people that believe the story. It's lower than usual. I could only find one result lower than that, actually. It was one poll done in Pakistan a couple of years ago, which had 3% of people. But basically, what I just find it fascinating that this population has managed to achieve its own worldview, or at least its own interpretation of this incident, and be resilient in maintaining that and even increasing that in the midst of all this propaganda that's going on around it. And, of course, as it happens, because of 10 years of research, I think British Muslims are right. I mean, if I thought they were wrong, I would have a different view of this, perhaps, but I think they're right.
Absolutely.
So, kind of encouraging.
Yeah, it is encouraging. And I have a question around that. You know, I'm wondering why more Muslims don't speak out if they get this in great numbers. And I guess I understand partly why they don't, but I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I think the very fact of how this poll was carried out gives us an idea of why they don't speak out. I mean, they're being intensely studied. They're being considered suspicious. Their loyalty is being questioned. There's a string of quote-unquote terrorist events that keeps happening in the West, which are immediately blamed on them. And that just goes to maintain the global war on terror and to maintain the fear and the suspicion and all that. Now, in my view, the majority of those terrorist incidents are frauds, just like 9/11. They
Yes.
have signs all over them that they are state operations meant to keep this absurd conflict, war on terror, going. And I don't say they're all frauds, but the ones I have actually begun looking into usually bear the same signs that we're familiar with, or having studied 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. And those two I've studied in great detail. And so when I see the same signs coming up, I go, oh, not this again. I think at this point in history, we have to assume that when one of these events happens, our initial assumption has to be that it's a false flag attack, it's a state operation, and that's the assumption. We could be wrong, but in that case, we'll need evidence to convince us we're wrong. In other words, my own perspective has changed from what it would have been maybe 12 years ago. 12 years ago, I might have said, well, I know there's lots of state deception. I've been studying war for a long time, but let's assume the official story of one of these things is correct, unless we see evidence to the contrary. I don't believe that anymore. There's so much fraud, I think we have to flip it and say, I'm going to assume it's a fake unless I see evidence.
Until proven otherwise, right.
Yeah.
And they all have some of the same characteristics. Maybe you could share with us what are some of the characteristics that you see that all of these have that lead us to believe they're false.
Well, one of the things is that they're usually able to identify the perpetrator very quickly. Another is that they often kill the perpetrator, so that there's no trial, there's no airing for the public of evidence. Police get to say what they'll show us and what they won't show us. And even what they do show us is often flimsy in the extreme. Their so-called perpetrators often make a point of leaving their identification at the scene. You know, they accidentally leave it in the taxi, as with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, or they have their passport on them when they're shot down, which is the case mm-hmm. with Michael Zihafibo in Ottawa, 2014. Again, a couple of recent incidents. Once again, we have identification found. I mean, come on, you know. And that obviously reminds us of the 9/11 case of, actually, there's a whole host of identification found at various sites. The most famous one is the passport found at the World Trade Center, which somehow escaped the conflagration, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Saddam al-Sukami. I think that's the passport that was found. But that was just an example. Then we had in Pennsylvania, we had all kinds of identification.
Their bandanas or something. Yeah.
even though there's no plane.
Right.
And they found all kinds of, you know, business cards and an ID and stuff, supposedly, at the Pentagon. I mean, that was so stupid. I can't see how anyone could believe it. So when we see this being replicated again, so really you can come up with a checklist, and there are such. Some people have come up with checklists.
Mm-hmm.
You can find them on the Internet. You know, if you find the following 12 characteristics, it's probably a fraud.
I know one of them is that there's usually some kind of a drill that's gone on before or during the event, and also often the perpetrators are known by the FBI and have connections to
these government and intelligence agencies.
Right. We had both of those, for example, in October 2014 in Canada. We had two so-called Muslim terrorist events that happened very quickly, that is, very closely together. One was, I think, October 20th, one was 22nd. These are really rare in Canada. And they had everything that we're talking about here. They had drills. They had all kinds of foreknowledge. I think our federal police denied that there was any warning at all. And actually, there were at least six, some of them very specific. There was a huge training exercise that had been going on for some time, which was carried out to simulate an attack in Quebec followed by attack in another city. Well, guess what? October 20th, province of Quebec, attack. 2 days later, attack in another city, Ottawa, and so on. So that one was there. What was the other one you mentioned? Oh, the RCMP knew these people. Yeah, sure. Well, the Maldives had actually been having regular visits with one of these guys. And the other guy had a big criminal record, and, you know, and they knew all about him. And he was a homeless man who somehow suddenly managed to get hold of a car and a gun. And I wrote a whole report about that one. It was so silly. So those are two more characteristics. We find them all over the place. There they are, Boston Marathon, good training going on.
Oh, yes. So, and another example of the supposed perpetrators being connected to the FBI and had been watched by them, and they'd been to their home and all
right.
of that.
So your initial question was, why do Muslims not speak out? And I think we're answering it as we go along. I mean, they're under attack. It's not paranoia. Most of them are ordinary folks who want to live a normal life in the country that they're in. And if they're in the West, they want to, to a large extent, integrate. I don't mean give up their religion and all their beliefs and so on, but on the whole, they want to integrate. They want their kids to be able to go to school without being harassed. They don't want people looking at them like terrorists when they go to work in the day. And so it's been my experience, certainly within my own country, knowing the Muslim community in my own city and in neighboring cities, that generally on this issue, they keep their head down. And that doesn't mean that some of them aren't grateful when others of us are willing to speak out about it. It's safer for me to speak about it than it is for them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, in this poll that was done that you were talking about here in Britain, how did they twist or spin the results? And that's why you were motivated to write the article.
Well, one of the things, I mean, they couldn't do much about violence since, as I say, Muslims answered questions about political violence by being less sympathetic to it than the control group. So they latched on to a couple of other terms or other ideas. One was that somehow Muslims were racists and were blaming it on Jews. But the others were two different terms. One was conspiracy theory and one is extremism. So they asked this question about 9/11, I think, partly to entrap the population and to say, look at them, they're conspiracy theorists. And we'll now argue that conspiracy theory is very dangerous, that it feeds into what they call extremism and terrorism, and that therefore it's scary and we need to try and work on that. So the results that I gave you would show that Muslims in the UK don't believe the official story of 9/11. Somehow Policy Exchange wants to make that into a scary finding. Now they do it, first of all, they ask several questions in the poll in which they use the term conspiracy theory and in which they use the term extremism. They never define either term, okay? They never define. That's really, really important because these are two very important terms in the war on terror. Conspiracy theory has been just a goldmine for people who are trying to smear those of us who question the official story. It sounds so intellectually sophisticated. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, ha, 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 whereas I am sophisticated. But, of course, you don't define it, because if you define it, it'll turn out that what you're saying makes no sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, conspiracy theory, the obvious meaning of that is a theory which asserts that a conspiracy took place. Right? I mean, that's the obvious meaning, and that's the way it was used, for example, after the John Kennedy's assassination. There were two choices. One was that there was a lone gunman, usually said to be Lee Harvey Oswald, and the other was that there was a conspiracy, meaning more than one person. And a conspiracy is where two or more people get together in secret to plan an immoral or illegal act, right? So what would that mean to say that there's a conspiracy theory about 9/11? I mean, it's obvious there's no lone gunman option.
Right.
No way one person, no matter how evil they are, they didn't do the whole thing. They didn't hijack four planes simultaneously, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious, in other words, that regardless of who you think did 9/11, it was two or more people. Well, it was more than two. It was multiple people. Obviously, it was a crime. And obviously, they didn't plan it in public, right? They
mm-hmm.
planned it in secret. Therefore, it was a conspiracy. And therefore, using the obvious meaning of the term conspiracy theory, there is no theory that can possibly account for 9/11 except a conspiracy theory. And therefore, the decision we have to make isn't between conspiracy theory and something else. It's between the government, the official conspiracy theory, in which Al-Qaeda are the conspirators, and one or the other conspiracy, right?
Right.
So, for example, of course I think people conspired. Of course. And a lot of them were people in the state, in the government of the U.S. Others were, may have been in foreign intelligence agencies, so on and so forth. So I'm going on at length about this just to say that, as you obviously already know this, but I'm saying this for people listening, this conspiracy theory term is usually meant purely as a propaganda term. And the people who use it very seldom are willing to unpack it, because it just doesn't work when you begin looking at it. So here we have a survey in which people are asked about conspiracy theories without defining it. And they're asked about extremism, which is also a very important term, and there's no definition. So here's an example of a question asked on the poll in the UK. Quote, "From time to time, we all come across so-called conspiracy theories," and that's put in quotation marks, "which supposedly explain events in a different way to commonly held beliefs. You may have seen or heard about conspiracy theories about, for example, the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York on 9/11. To what extent do you agree or disagree with the following statements?" They then give a few, and here's one statement. "Conspiracy theories are started by extremists trying to dupe Muslims into support for their views." Okay? I mean, when I read that in the poll, I just started to laugh. I mean, that's obvious propaganda. First of all, this violates the basic principles of public polling. You never ask a question using a term that you don't define and that is seriously unclear. So that's the first sign that this isn't a sincere public poll. It's something else going on. And I think what's going on is a form of entrapment, actually, trying to get people to say certain things that can be used against them.
Right. And another word they used is duped. Like, if you believe in conspiracy theories, you've been duped by extremists. And who wants to be duped?
Well, who wants to be duped, indeed?
Yeah.
And who wants to be associated with extremism, which is the other term here? Because you have to remember that there's a whole thing, debate going on in the UK for some years now about this concept of extremism. Finally, I found it defined in a UK government document from around 2011, where extremism is defined as something, I'm sorry, I don't have the thing here, but it's something like public opposition to fundamental British values. Think about that for a minute. Well, they give examples of fundamental British values, and the examples are things you and I would, I'm sure, like democracy and tolerance of different faiths and so on. But there are several things going on here. First of all, those values are not distinctly British. There are people in all kinds of parts of the world who affirm those. But secondly, those are precisely the values that the war on terror is putting at risk. And I'm suspicious of anybody who defines a term like extremism in terms of national values. It reminds me of, you know, the house on un-American
activities. Yeah.
As soon as you're talking about somebody's in trouble if they're un-American or they're un-British or something, then you've got something really fishy going on here.
Yes.
So extremism is a term that's under debate in the UK for good reason. I think it should be rejected completely. But part of the reason it's being defined that way is because the people in government who are pushing this notion of extremism do not want it to be, how shall I put this, they do not want violence to be an essential part of the definition. I mean, if extremism were to mean what many people assume it means, that people are doing some kind of horrible, unjustified violence, then obviously Sherrold and Graham McQueen aren't extremists, because we're not pushing violence. But they want us to be part of that circle, just like they want British Muslims as a whole to be in danger of this thing called extremism. So they are deliberately creating a category, and they say this, like when he was Prime Minister, Cameron publicly said that he was against all forms of extremism, including, folks, nonviolent extremism. That's his term. And what we see in this poll that I am discussing here is that the current effort by the political right in the UK is to make so-called conspiracy theories, generally undefined, okay, to make that a part of this thing called nonviolent extremism.
Yes.
Where I'm going.
Yes, so it's an attack on anybody who challenges the official story.
Absolutely. An attack which has a very scary direction here, because what they're really heading for, and they've got legislation in the works in the UK, is to not only make so-called conspiracy theorists, you know, like us, to not only make us taboo and somehow polluted and ridiculous and all those things which they've been trying to do all along, but to actually make it illegal to hold such opinions. It's something we need to be aware of this.
I agree. And now with the attack on the, quote, fake news, they're trying to get at all the alternative outlets where we can share this information, and they're attacking us that way, too. And they're going to make that even illegal to do. Yeah, it is a major attack. I see that. I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assault which needs to be checked. And unfortunately, mainstream media, political parties have had a fair bit of success in the West in this employment of terms like conspiracy theory. And so it's possible that they'll get some fishy law through a parliament here or there that will make it much harder for us to have freedom of expression and freedom of research and to find out and communicate the truth about our times.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with Dr. Graham McQueen, Canadian professor and author. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that interview. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Take a walk with me. Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud?
Building Bridges presents a rogues gallery of Trumpism. The lineup of the dirty dealers and defenders of the indefensible who are definitely not making America great again, but are making it hate again. Donald Trump has assembled a rogues gallery of alt-right hate mongers, crony capitalists, immigrant bashers, and climate change deniers to run the American government. And to survive the next 4 years, we, the people, need to know whose hands are on the levers of power and who better to flesh out the scoundrels than John Nichols.
John Nichols is a national affairs writer for The Nation magazine, the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and a co-founder of the media reform group Free Press. And his most recent book is The Horsemen of the Trumpopolis, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America.
And so I had this encyclopedic rogues gallery before me, and I came away with, I'm sorry, John, this was probably not your intent, but I wouldn't say demoralization or depression, but I came away with a sense, again, that there are parallels with the character and ascent of Adolf Hitler, who was underestimated, who was narcissistic, who was a demagogue, and had total disregard for the truth. So I'm almost overwhelmed, but can't think of a more important contribution than to parse out whose hands are really on the levers, because I don't see Trump himself as the ideologue. So which of these terrible scoundrels do you want to start with?
Well, Mimi, thanks for the introduction. And also, look, it's not inappropriate to feel overwhelmed. And nor is it necessary to make comparisons to the 1930s. The fact of the matter is that in American history, we have had some pretty awful presidents, and they have done a tremendous amount of damage. But what I try to argue in the book is that no president, no matter how narcissistic, no matter how evil, if that be the case, is capable of doing all the harm on his or her own. The fact of the matter is that when someone is elected to the presidency, they cease to be an individual. They become an administration. And it's the people that they put in positions of power that we have to pay immense attention to. Because if we only follow Donald Trump's tweets, we will not know what is being done in our name and without our informed consent. And so with that said, let me offer up as probably the most dangerous player at this point, somebody that people are quite familiar with but should know more about, and that's Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. I open the chapter on Sessions with a question, and that is, what can be said about Attorney General Jeff Sessions that hasn't already been said by Dr. David Duke?
Now you're taking me from Hitler back to something like the end time for those who may be more religious than the Four Horsemen indeed. What more can be said about Mr. Sessions, who certainly is a Kluxer sympathizer, who is one of the most retrograde forces, and speaking as a member of the legal profession, one of the more backward, destructive, counterproductive people in his various incarnations, from senator to before that attorney general and so on. So what more can we punctuate?
Well, this is what's scary about Jeff Sessions. You know, you say some things that many people have referenced, and his history is one that's been deeply troubling to civil rights activists, to civil liberties activists, to folks who simply care about the rule of law. But it's important to understand that Jeff Sessions is a favorite of the alt-right, of many of the most extreme players on the alt-right. When I was writing this book, I did something that frankly wasn't very pleasant. I spent a lot of time looking at the social media of these neo-fascists and new Confederates and all the players who've suddenly become very prominent in the aftermath of Charlottesville. And what was striking to me was the uniformity with which they praised and celebrated Jeff Sessions. In fact, David Duke, the longtime KKK figure, now with other white power, so-called white power groups, has regularly praised Sessions. In fact, when Sessions became Attorney General, David Duke had a portrait of him up on Duke's website of Sessions. And what's significant is that when many of these white nationalists on their social media talk about who they're excited about in this administration, they acknowledge that Trump is not, as they refer to, and it's a remarkable term, a racially conscious man. But they say there are people in his administration that they feel they can count on, or at least that they feel are aware of their assessment on the issues. And they cite, as you might expect, Steve Bannon, now sort of out of the administration, but not very far, I would argue. But they also cite Jeff Sessions. And, interestingly enough, another figure, Stephen Miller, the presidential aide, who many people have seen on television and in remarkably scary performances defending the Trump administration. But I think it's important to recognize that no matter where Jeff Sessions and Stephen Miller are politically, no matter what their precise place is, they are celebrated with some frequency by some of the most extreme players in the United States. And historically, that would have raised profound questions about whether they should be anywhere near the White House or the Department of Justice. Under Donald Trump, they're not just near the White House and the Department of Justice. In the case of Sessions, he's running the Department of Justice. In the case of Miller, he helped to write Donald Trump's inaugural address. He was a key player in advancing the Muslim ban, and there is pretty good evidence to suggest that he had some hand in the pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in recent days. So these are really bad players, and they are very close to the center of power in this country, and we ought to be talking a lot more about who they are and what they do.
Well, one of the things that I found most interesting is, and you've begun to research this, and we've had our discussions back in when Trump first declared his presidency. And your book is kind of, somebody described it as the secular equivalent of, indeed, of end time, even having its four horsemen of the apocalypse. But these things, for example, people like the Mercers, who supported Trump from the inception. What happened to the media when Mr. Trump first descended from that opulent, decadent, gold leaf pavilion that he occupied in Trump Tower, on the golden staircase, the golden escalator came down, castigated in the most virulent racist terms, immigrants, Mexicans, and so on. These backers were already in line. What prevented the media? Is that really one of the horsemen that indeed should have been added to this book? I mean, we've got the Breitbarts and we've got the Bannons and so on, but they knew these things. Why was it taken with such a cavalier response? Is it because they themselves are part of the oligarchy in essence? I mean, how do you understand that?
That's a very good question. And yeah, as you know, I've dealt with media issues for a long time. And there is
by the way, I was talking specifically about people like Robert and Rebecca Mercer, who, you know, gave incredible amounts of money to the Trump campaign.
And also really in many ways shaped it. Let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. First off, the media was incredibly inept in covering Donald Trump. First off, they underestimated him. Second, they didn't take him seriously. They saw him as entertainment rather than, a serious contender for the presidency of the United States. And the fact of the matter is that every interview with Donald Trump should have focused on issues. It should have been very precise. It should have made, you know, real demands of him. Instead, so much of the coverage of Trump was just kind of verbatim video of his rallies and this, again, bad theater of the Trump candidacy. So there wasn't enough exploring of who was behind him and why he was advancing politically, even when he seemed to be such a ridiculous player in so many ways. And the Mercers are the answer to a lot of those questions. They're very, very wealthy people. Robert Mercer, a tech genius, to say the least, somebody who made a tremendous amount of money and now spends that money to advance extremely right-wing causes. Now, it's interesting, the Mercer operation initially had several candidates it was interested in, including Ted Cruz. But when Trump became the obvious nominee, the Mercers focused in on him. And this is where it got interesting. Over the years, the Mercers have funded activities, media initiatives by Steve Bannon. They have also funded projects in which Kellyanne Conway was very closely involved. Now, here's the fascinating thing that happened. When Trump needed a fall campaign team, who came in? Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway. What was the connection? Well, the connection is the Mercers. And Donald Trump is so reliant on the Mercers, so deferent to them in many ways, that when they had their annual costume party after the election, they had, you know, Kellyanne Conway was there and all sorts of other players in the administration. But so, too, was Donald Trump. You know, we always think about, you know, political influence peddlers and lobbyists and wealthy players coming to the president of the United States, wanting to influence the president of the United States. Well, in the case of the Mercers, Donald Trump goes to them. And that's a lot of what you need to know about their immense power. And I would give one final element. I write about them. They're the first folks mentioned in the book because so much of the web of intrigue and activity around Donald Trump traces back to them. Now, there has been some very good reporting on them in recent months. But what's troubling to me, and what, as you reference here, is that we really didn't pay sufficient attention to them during the campaign. And it was during the campaign that all of the pieces that they had been kind of putting on the table for a long time came together around Donald Trump's candidacy. And I think it's very important to understand them in the same way that we understand the Koch brothers, in the same way we think about Sheldon Adelson. These are very, very influential, very powerful people who are not just supporting a candidate. They are really shaping the direction of the United States with their campaign contributions, but also with the fact that they are simply at the table influencing Donald Trump.
And what about Mike Mulvaney and the new budget that's going to come up, which will just strip away rights of the poor and middle class and feed the Pentagon.
You're exactly right. And that, and you focused on the precise reason that I spent so much time on Mulvaney. Mulvaney is, again, a tremendously under-examined figure. He was a congressman from down in the Carolinas. He was so extreme that he was really on the fringe of Republicans in the House of Representatives who thought he was just off the deep end in his willingness to shut down the federal government, in his disdain for domestic programs that are immensely popular. And so Trump's selection of him was an unsettling choice right from the start. And it was also a signal that, you know, the fantasists who imagined that Donald Trump might govern from the center or that he might not be as extremely right-wing as some of us feared were disproven when Mulvaney came in. Mulvaney is a classic supporter of austerity for domestic programs, austerity for the people who live in the United States, and immense largesse for the military. And so he recreates the worst of the Reagan era. This is a guy who wants to cut domestic programs to the bone. He wants to shift the money over to the Pentagon. He's quite open about that. You know, tens of billions of dollars going to the Pentagon. And at the same time, he supports massive tax cuts for the wealthy. Now, I don't claim to be the greatest expert in economics ever, but I can tell you this. If you gut domestic programs, many of which do move money back into the economy, if you shift that money over to the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, which is just, you know, rife with waste, as Dwight Eisenhower warned us, and also dangerous in a whole bunch of other ways, and then you do massive tax cuts for the wealthy, you are going to create an economic crisis. I promise you that's the case. And that's what Mulvaney is overseeing. And the failure to examine him, to look at what he's doing on a daily basis, is really one of the things that concerns me most about the coverage of this administration. I believe strongly that we should cover all the things that Donald Trump does. I think we should cover his tweets. I think we should cover his statements. I think we should hold him to account on a regular basis. No question of that. But we also have to expand our focus so that we look at what people like Mulvaney, Scott Pruitt at the EPA, Jeff Sessions at the Justice Department, all these generals in charge of defense and other agencies. We need to look at these people and watch what they're doing on a regular basis, because in many cases, Donald Trump has ceded power to them and given them the go-ahead to advance what is, by any measure, the most radically right-wing governance of the United States in its history, and that includes the Reagan era at its worst.
You know, one of the other things about Mulvaney that hit me, and that was I started reading some of the proofs of your book before Donald Trump made his speech. I mean, I was thinking about now the acceptance of not a nation building strategy. This is a strategy of an acceptance of perpetual war. And of course, what is war good for? Absolutely nothing except not to mention Edwin Starr and that great song. But the fact of the matter is, who's it good for? The profiteers. It's good for the armaments industry, etc. And Mulvaney seems to be perfectly placed, and that seems to be part of the budgetary concerns as well, which I think why it was so critical that you raised him up as one of the sinister people in this rogues gallery that we've got to know better.
Yeah, in fact, I include Mulvaney in the section where I examine the military-industrial complex. And I also include Secretary of State Rex Tillerson there, because it is – you don't just have to be a general. You don't just have to be at the Pentagon to be relevant to the military-industrial complex. If you are downsizing and diminishing the State Department, as Rex Tillerson clearly is, he is doing tremendous damage to diplomacy and to all that you might hope for, and admitting that there have been many failures in the past, but to any potential for alternatives to militarism, he's diminishing that at the State Department. At the same time, Mulvaney shifting money from domestic programs to the Pentagon. And so you end up in a situation where under Donald Trump, we are fully realizing the worst fears of Dwight Eisenhower. And it's weird that in this book, Eisenhower is a major player. And it's not because I think Eisenhower was the best guy around. It's not because I agree with everything he did or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, as a former general, he spent an immense amount of time in the 1950s warning about two things. Number one, warning that if you spent too much on the Pentagon, you would ultimately exhaust your available resources, and that would harm domestic programs, domestic stability. And secondly, that there is indeed a military-industrial complex, that there is an interplay between the Pentagon and corporations and individuals who make a lot of money by building up the military, expanding militarism, and ultimately putting us on a war footing that almost certainly leads toward war. And I think that one thing about this book that may distinguish it from most of the things that are written about Trump is that I spent a lot of time on the military-industrial complex and on Trump's association with it, because I think that is, to my mind, the most undercovered aspect of the Trump presidency.
Well, I think what your book for me did most significantly is it really weeded out what is the ideology. If it's not about Trump, it's about those that surround him are really molding him and solidifying some of the kind of nascent knee-jerk reactions he might have had to things. But he has surrounded himself with ideologues. And we now have the generals in effect and control. So we haven't even scratched the surface of this enormously important book. So I hope we're going to be able to get you back again to continue to ferret out who these people are. And are you going to be in the New York area anytime soon? Because I think we should host a book reading with you.
I'd love to do an event with WBAI. That would be a great pleasure. I'm not doing a New York event on this tour. My first event is Wednesday night in Washington at Politics and Prose, perhaps a very appropriate spot. We'll have C-SPAN there as well. And then I'll be out doing a lot of things. But I'll be back in New York. I come often. And
it's a really readable book with some great, great graphics, which I can really speak to. They are just searing caricatures. This is a factually insightful portrait, both the visuals and the content, of the corporatist managers, the plutocracy, the oligarchs who really are the wrecking, somebody had said, the giant wrecking machine of the Trumponaut, the juggernaut. And the book that we are talking about, which is a must-get for you, is The Four Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse by the wondrous writer and national critic, John Nichols.
You've been more generous than I deserve. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and also encouragement to really start to look at the whole of the Trump administration. When we do, we're going to see that things are being done in our name and without our informed consent, that are incredibly destructive. If we're going to resist, we have to resist them all.
I'm going to give you one more minute, just one more minute to talk about, and literally Elaine Chao, because of what's going on in Texas.
Yes. Well, it's just simple. We don't even need a minute. On August 15th, Elaine Chao, with President Trump, announced that they were gutting President Obama's rule to make sure that all new infrastructure, bridges, roads, was climate resilient, i.e. that they're ready for these rising tides, for this flooding, for all of these issues. And Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, in charge of a lot of Donald Trump's proposed $1 trillion infrastructure program, literally gutted out and worked with Trump to gut out protections to make sure that our infrastructure can deal with flooding. Obviously, what we're looking at today is not a direct result of that, but it is unimaginable. It is unimaginable, as we look forward to spending huge amounts of money on infrastructure, that we wouldn't have a rule that would guarantee that it would be resilient in the case of flooding and all the threats that we're seeing in such tragic illustration down in Houston. So I find Chao to be an incredibly dangerous player, and she's also Mitch McConnell's wife. And we really should be examining what she's doing, because it's very, very threatening to the environment and, frankly, just to the basic good governance as regards infrastructure.
And we've been speaking with John Nichols, and you must get the Four Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a critical book for those of us who wish to be and are agents for social change. Thanks, John.
Thank you. It was a very good pleasure to be with you.
Dear Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave a road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay? President, you'd never take a walk with me.
Telling it like it is, Pink's Dear Mr. President. You?
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Asking in a queer space about pronouns doesn't stop me from being removed from women's toilets, doesn't stop the weird looks and crawling humiliation. The only thing that really stops that feeling has to be myself, has to be writing it down, has to be finding others like me and being able to speak it out loud.
Our dual butch identity is somehow unacceptable. For many, the idea of two butch women being together is confusing, and two butch mothers is more confusing still.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. India's High Court privacy ruling signals sodomy law repeal, Finland retains infertility rule for legal gender change, and why butch is not a dirty word. All that and more this week, because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 26, 2017. The August 24th decision in a privacy rights case at India's Supreme Court could signal the demise of the country's notorious anti-queer penal code, Section 377, a holdover from British colonial rule that outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature. The case challenged mandatory use of national biometric identity cards. They're required to receive government services or to even open a bank account or to get a phone line. Privacy advocates challenged the mandatory cards because they collect a slew of personal information and data. India's Attorney General argued that the right to privacy must be forsaken in the interest of welfare entitlements. But the 9-judge bench ruled that the right to individual privacy is an intrinsic and fundamental right under the country's constitution. The justices took potshots in their 547-page privacy decision at a previous 3-judge panel high court ruling upholding Section 377. This week's edict called sexual orientation an essential attribute of privacy. The rights of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender population cannot be construed to be so-called rights, the High Court said, attacking a conclusion in the earlier decision. Their rights are not so-called, but are real rights, founded on sound constitutional doctrine. Foes of Section 377 have unsuccessfully lobbied the government for many years to repeal the law. In a separate case, a larger High Court bench is specifically reviewing that earlier 3-judge panel ruling that upheld it. In light of the strong connection the justices made this week between privacy rights and the fundamental right to queer identity, LGBTQ activists are hoping that the larger High Court bench will finally strike down Section 377 as unconstitutional.
But in a setback for transgender rights, Finland's government announced on August 25th that it had decided to maintain the requirement that trans people be sterilized before they're allowed to change their legal gender. The decision thumbs its nose at a recommendation of the United Nations Human Rights Council that Finland join its Nordic neighbors Denmark and Sweden in dropping the requirement. The European Court of Human Rights also ruled in a case in April that requiring sterilization for gender recognition is a human rights violation. The Finnish government gave no reason for rejecting the proposed change, stating only that the abolition of the infertility requirement is not included in the current government's legislative plan.
A White House memo has outlined some of the details of President Trump's ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. It instructs the Pentagon to refuse to admit new transgender recruits, to stop paying for the trans-related health care of currently serving members, and to not renew their enlistment contracts. The memo gives the Pentagon 6 months to implement the ban, which Trump infamously announced on Twitter in late July, reversing course on the Obama administration's plan to fully integrate transgender enlistees into the U.S. Armed Forces. The National Center for Lesbian Rights and GLBTQ legal advocates and defenders have already filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the ban. Advocacy groups Lambda Legal and OutServe SLDN announced this week that they'll be filing their own lawsuit. Los Angeles Blade reporter Karen Oakham reports that religious right ideologue and Vice President Mike Pence has been the moving force behind the bigotry. In fact, she wrote, he has been spearheading the trans ban reinstatement since last May at the behest of conservative leaders such as Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council and scores of retired anti-LGBT military officers. Trump's fear of his evangelical base, Oakham concludes, is more powerful than his promises to the LGBT community. Thousands of transgender people are currently serving honorably in the U.S. Armed Forces.
Meanwhile, Lambda Legal has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education, seeking documents related to the withdrawal earlier this year of Obama-era guidelines on how schools should treat their transgender students. A press release charged that the departments pulled the rug out from under transgender students, leaving them even more vulnerable to harassment and abuse. We need to know why. The non-binding guidelines issued in 2016 under President Obama recommended that schools use trans students' preferred names and pronouns and allow them access to restrooms, locker rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities that match their gender identity. It also provided guidance on dress codes, privacy issues, and protection from bullying and harassment. The guidelines were withdrawn in February, a month after Donald Trump was sworn in as the nation's 45th president. Under a Freedom of Information Act filing in March, Lambda requested correspondence with any groups outside the government, communications with the president's staff, and instructions to staff about how to handle inquiries and complaints about discrimination, bullying, and harassment based on gender identity or transgender status. But neither Attorney General Jeff Sessions' Justice Department nor Secretary Betsy DeVos' Education Department has complied. Lambda filed its suit on August 22nd in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York.
In other news, fears that a marriage equality postal plebiscite in Australia would give license to hateful anti-queer campaign rhetoric have been realized. Resisting a free vote in Parliament, which would almost certainly open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples down under, the coalition government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is pushing a voluntary, non-binding postal vote as the only way to resolve the issue. Stop the Fags posters, citing scurrilous information about homosexuality, such as equating gay people with pedophiles and labeling same-gender attraction a curse of death, have sprung up in and around Melbourne. Flyers calling lesbian and gay people the tragedy of a family have appeared in Sydney. Leaflets in English and Chinese, distributed among the large Asian community in the Sydney suburb of Hurstville, warned that voting for marriage equality would open the door to counterfeit women rapists in public restrooms. The Australian Traditional Nationalist Group, which claims to advocate the protection of white identity and the traditional Western values rooted in Christian and pagan traditions, is behind posters in Brisbane targeting families headed by same-gender couples. Mothers and fathers' love is irreplaceable, they read. Traditional marriage must be protected. Opposition Labour Party leader Bill Shorten has been among the many critics of Turnbull's push for the postal plebiscite. We know this bile will end up in the playground, in the schoolyard, and on the sporting field, Shorten said. The slogans will be shouted at the children of same-sex couples. Young people who are gay will be confronted by it on social media every day.
The postal plebiscite is set to begin in mid-September and run through early November. However, some LGBTQ activists are challenging the validity of the $122 million proposal in Australia's High Court. Their case is scheduled to be heard in early September, so the way forward isn't at all clear until a ruling comes down. There were encouraging signs for equality activists this week if the vote does go forward. The Australian Electoral Commission released information about what it called an extraordinary surge in the number of people registering to vote in the postal plebiscite ahead of the August 24th deadline. Since the marriage equality vote was announced in early August, almost a million Australians had either enrolled for the first time, mostly young people, or updated their voter registration status. and a poll conducted by the Rupert Murdoch-owned Australian newspaper less than a month away from the proposed postal plebiscite showed almost 2 in 3 voters are planning to say yes to marriage equality.
And finally, Ugandan queer activists and their supporters ended a challenging week with a secret pride celebration in Kampala. For the second year in a row, the government shut down a planned LGBTQ pride festival by threatening violent police intervention. Organizers of this year's scheduled events reluctantly announced the cancellation through a statement in the Kuchu Times, citing serious concerns for the safety of participants. All Out and Rainbow Riots, two of Pride Uganda's international partners, spearheaded what All Out executive director Matt Beard called a gathering that was full of joy and defiance. To ensure safety, the location was kept secret, and drivers took all the invited Pride celebrants to the venue. Writing on his Facebook page that, "We danced the night away," Petter Wallenberg, founder of Rainbow Riots, said that, "We couldn't let this week finish without reaching some kind of triumphant conclusion." Local activists vow to push for more visibility. Isaac Mugisha, chair of the Pride Uganda Organizing Committee, told the Washington Blade that there is no way people will accept that there are LGBT people in Uganda if we don't stand out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 26, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
To every young man who can't pass, from every lipstick, lazy lass, from every drag queen's high-heeled stagger, every bull dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, yeah.
The art of understanding and talking about gender identity issues has deepened over the last generation. From feminism's reevaluation of the role of women in the 1960s through the LGBT liberation movement and the development of queer theory, the many nuances of gender expression are becoming clearer. Giselle Hanna of 3CR Community Radio Melbourne's Accent of Women program chats with two contributors to a new Australian magazine dedicated to one swaggering aspect of the gender discussion.
Butch is not a dirty word is the brainchild of butch activist Esther Godoy. This publication is about reclaiming female masculinity and the identity butch. What started as a photography project grew into a place for queer voices to express their thoughts and experiences about butch identity. Madeline Imber is one of the co-editors and Tandiwe Abimoyo is a contributing writer. Let's just start with, what is butch?
My name's Madeline. I think it really, like, the point of the publication, and I guess my perspective is it's a self-identification. So, you know, I guess anyone can identify as butch. The thing that drew me to the zine was my personal experience of being read as masculine of centre as a woman. So part of it was being read as a lesbian and any kind of issues or positive aspects that came from that, but also being read as male. The reason that I responded to Esther's call out was that I worked a lot in schools. I worked in a lot of different schools and I would travel around the state going into classrooms and I would often get a little bit of heckling from some of the kids because I look masculine of centre and they couldn't work out if I was male or female, or they thought I was a lesbian or they assumed I was a lesbian, and kind of I got a little bit of abuse for that. And they're kids, it's fine. It was manageable in that context. But, you know, every now and then I'd get home and be quite frustrated by it and frustrated by the state of our education system, but also frustrated that this was an experience I was having and I didn't have a community around me that reflected it. And so when I saw the call out, it wasn't about getting my face in the zine or, you know, necessarily writing something for it. It was about finding a community because I'd spent enough time whinging that I didn't have one. I thought I was just going to have to go and seek it out. So for me, it's about my experience as someone who doesn't look conforming in terms of my female gender, and I don't conform to what society feels like I should look like. And so that's my perspective on why I guess at various points in time I have and do identify as butch.
Hi, I'm Tundi. I think I would probably echo a lot of that in terms of it's about self-identification. I think for me, I spent quite a number of years living in the States, and I think that's probably when I came into my own kind of identity as a butch. It was kind of handed to me. I think other people there just kind of read me and assumed I identified as butch. And then it started to kind of fit and feel good and reflect how I kind of felt comfortable moving in the world and wanted other people to kind of read me. When I moved back to Australia, I found that there wasn't really much of a community around butch identified or masculine women. So when I saw the zine come together with the first issue, it was pretty exciting.
I want to talk about butch inside the queer and the broader LGBTI community. And I think there have been a lot of advances in the LGBTI movement. You know, same-sex marriage has a lot of traction and is reaching quite broad public acceptance. But with that comes a greater space for other issues, particularly I'm talking about gender identity and a conversation around non-binary gender and transgender and so on. And I wonder what you think and what you have to say about butch versus trans. And I even get the complexity of that construction as well. But do you feel like butch gets collapsed with trans at all? And then what's your response to that?
You know, speaking personally, I don't want to speak for the zine, especially around issues that are so complex, but I think what the positivity of the first and the second edition has been very much based around inclusivity. So the idea that the trans movement, you're right, has gained a lot of traction in the last few years, and the trans community is really coming into its own and come into a really strong political space, which is fantastic. And I think that the zine is about being part of the broader queer space and around the identity of butch not being seen as a dirty word and being seen as another identity within the queer community, obviously different to trans, but also something that in some ways troubles or messes with gender. And I think the more that we can trouble gender and talk about that and open up a space, the healthier it is. It's not about a dichotomy of, well, you're either butch or trans, or those two things are in opposition. It's very much about there's room for all of them. What pronouns do you prefer? This is a new question. I often confuse people with my gender presentation, but twice now I've been asked what pronouns I prefer, and it makes me uncomfortable. It shouldn't, because they're well-intentioned. It's a way to acknowledge everyone's experiences and sense of self. And I've often felt my sense of self is lacking, so I should appreciate this effort. I hear women talk of the power of their high heels, the power of that favourite dress, and how when they're getting all dressed up, they feel sexy, powerful, invincible. I feel that way in a finely cut pair of pants, a crisp shirt and boots. And I can't work out what it is about a fresh, sharp haircut that makes me feel like $1 million, but it does. And then I leave the house. Despite being used to it, it doesn't take much. A double take from a smirking teenager, a confused look from a middle-aged woman, perplexed, then disgusted. And then my swagger shrinks and the shame sets in. I suddenly feel the shame of the world seeing me as a young boy, then more shame when they realise I'm butch. My clothes can be my armour, but also my undoing. I never know how I'm going to be read, but I can recognise the revulsion a mile away. And from strangers I can sometimes bear it. The twist of the knife is when it comes from women who like it, as long as no one else can see me with them. I think most of the time they don't even know. They can't articulate the shame they feel for desiring someone who looks like me, and how that desire marks them as deviant too. At these times, I feel an intense amount of shame, shame that being asked about my preferred pronouns should counteract, but for some reason it doesn't. Asking in a queer space about pronouns doesn't stop me from being removed from women's toilets, doesn't stop the weird looks and crawling humiliation. The only thing that really stops that feeling has to be myself, has to be writing it down, has to be finding others like me and being able to speak it out loud, has to be knowing there's nothing to be ashamed of.
want to talk a little bit about some of the taboos. Well, just while we're talking about the complexities of gender identity and the label or the identity of butch, because I think a lot of people would also assume that butch was femme attracted, for example, and that there is a whole world of assumptions associated with butch, like it is inherently masculine and therefore male replicating. And I wanted, Tandi, I wanted to put that to you a little bit, particularly about this idea that butch and femme go together and there's no other way around that.
Well, my partner's also butch identified, so as a kind of butch couple, we have kind of confronted that quite a bit. I think particularly in the States where there is this much stronger, I think, butch femme community, it's really challenging, I think, for a lot of people in that community when there are two butch women together. I think some of the reactions that we experienced over the years reminded me, I guess, of kind of the sort of revulsion and panic that straight men sometimes exhibit towards gay men, that other butch women would kind of find the idea of two butchers together as kind of repulsive and wrong and, you know, dysfunctional, as those kinds of homophobic attitudes. And that was really hard to deal with, especially from, you know, your friends who you kind of think you actually share a lot in common with.
And you're also a parent.
Yeah.
So I wonder how public perceptions of you as a butch parent and a butch couple parenting children.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how many more complexities I can throw into the mix.
Sure. Look, I think there is an assumption that, you know, parents and, you know, mothers are feminine and that that is where the nurturing side of, you know, being a mother comes from. And so I think if you sort of embrace your more masculine attributes, that's kind of seen as being the antithesis of being a good and nurturing mother. I've been a stay-at-home mum for the last 6-7 years. And I think that certainly within the predominantly kind of straight world of mums and young kids, it's hard for people to read me as being a masculine woman. I think it's easy for them to read my partner as a butch woman because the analogy of, you know, her being kind of like their husbands or, you know, the fathers who go to work and wear a suit and tie and, you know, do stuff on the weekends with their kids is easy to understand. But I think it's been hard to kind of feel that I've been able to maintain my identity as a kind of masculine centre woman. When Nick and I got together and I started introducing her to my friends, people were confused. A few months into our relationship, I moved to the US while Nick stayed in London. I told my American friends about her and was beyond excited when she visited. I hadn't described her in great detail. It hadn't occurred to me that I should. I wasn't prepared for the reaction I got when Nick arrived and they realised that my partner was not femme, but another masculine-identified woman. The inherent naturalness of the butch-femme dichotomy is particularly strong among queers of colour, and the strongest sense of confusion, horror and rejection came from this community. One femme friend in particular clearly felt a very personal sense of betrayal. Her identity was so firmly rooted in her femme self that me choosing a butch partner and breaking those unwritten rules ultimately strained our friendship to a point from which it never fully recovered. Some years later, when Nick and I moved back to my hometown of Melbourne, we were getting ready to have children and therefore had less involvement in the queer community. We both knew we wanted kids, it was just a question of who and how. Although, of course, nothing is ever that simple in the world of lesbian fertility, I like to say that in the end, I drew the short straw and scored the role of carrying our two children. Pregnancy itself wasn't easy. I didn't relish the changes to my body and my wardrobe the way I know many women do. But I figured it was only 9 months and then things would get back to normal, right? I assumed, perhaps naively, that once our child was born, the small detail of who had given birth would fade into insignificance, that I would be free to embrace my more masculine attributes once again, and that the sense of social equality that Nick and I had enjoyed previously would resume. However, as a stay-at-home mum for 6 years and counting, I find myself in a world that clearly expects that role to come bundled with femininity, and so is no longer able to read me as a masculine woman. Meanwhile, as the non-biological or birth mother, Nick is expected to fulfil some kind of father role, and her visible butchness only serves to reinforce this. In this way, we often find ourselves being divided into rigid gender roles in ways we didn't before becoming parents.
It is easy to feel that my butchness is erased while Nick's is enhanced, based on the biological and logistical choices we've made in forming our family. While I stay at home with our kids, we're both parents. Nick isn't the one throwing a football while I cook. Our roles are divided by time and skill, not by perception of gender. From looking for maternity wear, the options for masculine women were scarce and non-existent, to how many straight friends perceive us, butchness and gender has played into our family. At barbecues, women are making the salads while men take charge of cooking the meat, and we're expected to make a decision of sorts as to where we stand, quite literally. But who gave birth? By who knew which person better? In a well-meaning way, it felt like there was an assumption that because Nick is butch and wears a suit and tie to work, I must be femme. A loss of identity through having kids was unexpected. I expected to lose time, sleep, and independence, but I didn't think my sense of self would also be deeply challenged. In a return of what happened when we first got together, our dual butch identity is somehow unacceptable. For many, the idea of two butch women being together is confusing, and two butch mothers is more confusing still, and therefore one must be recast as femme or closer to it. The other day, however, in a shopping centre bathroom, I turned in the direction of a once familiar sound, a sharp intake of air, to find a horrified, confused woman staring back at me. After taking it all in, she spluttered out, "I know it must be awful for her," looking apologetically at my daughter, "but you really should take her into the gents." So despite a few challenges along the way, some days I successfully pull it off. A butch and a mum still receiving helpful guidance on which bathroom to use.
That was Madeline Imber and Tandi Way Abby Moyo. Make sure you look up butchisnotadirtyword.com and check out their Facebook page. Accent of Women is produced in the Melbourne studios of Community Radio 3CR with the financial assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you want to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can write to us at accentofwomen@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or like our page on Facebook. I'm Giselle Hannah.
I went to the ladies' room, I had to pee. Why was everybody staring at me? A little girl giggled, a lady gasped. One woman almost had a heart attack. She started doing the bulldagger swagger. Do the bulldagger swagger. Do the bulldagger swagger, yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Giselle Hanna and from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeader, produced by Steve Pride. Frank performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WESU Middletown, Connecticut, CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The late historian Howard Zinn wrote that to be hopeful in dark times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. In the America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness, Betsy Hartman argues that in a world beset by the very real horrors of nuclear weapons and global warming, on terrible display with Hurricane Harvey, we need to avoid the pull of doomsaying in the interest of building a better world. For apocalyptical thinking, she suggests, is a particularly American phenomenon, born of Christianity and empire. Hartman is Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. Betsy, between economic meltdowns and climate change, it's hard not to feel like we're living through unusually apocalyptical times. Are they exceptionally apocalyptic in your view?
Well, I think we've lived through times that were even more apocalyptic, like the Cold War, for example. But certainly it's a very difficult political time in the country with Trump in the leadership and denying climate change. And then, of course, the nuclear standoff with North Korea. I mean, there are plenty of things to feel apocalyptic about, but that doesn't mean we should. We should certainly feel concerned and do something about them, but it doesn't mean we should think it's the end of the world. And of course, now also with the hurricane in Houston and this massive flood, I think that also gives rise to a sense of doom, too.
Sure. You start your book by describing your own history, coming of age in the late 1960s. What was the sense in the air at that time?
Well, there was a sense that the world could end any day in a nuclear conflagration. And I grew up under the shadow of the atomic bomb. And that led, one of the interesting things about doing this book is I explored some of that nuclear history and also looked at people like Robert J. Lifton, who wrote about its impact on our psychology. And I think, you know, for my generation, I was coming of age in the 60s. It was both a heady and hopeful time in terms of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement. I mean, a lot was shifting in the country. There was a lot positive going on, but at the same time, we had the specter of nuclear war. And certainly in my case, I became part of the Back to the Land movement. There was kind of a survivalist ethos in that, wanting to escape kind of the military-industrial complex and the depredations of civilization and lead a more, you know, holistic and socialistic life. So I think, you know, there was a strange mix in a way, and I talk about this in the book, some of our kind of millennial yearnings that we wanted to the world to be a much better place, and we were hopeful that things could turn around overnight through revolution, or, you know, lifestyle changes, or we could totally reject what had come before.
You're suggesting in your book, The America Syndrome, that that sense of a world sort of spinning out of control, of the sense that the world could end, is not particular to the late 20th century and the early 21st century, that in fact it has quite deep roots in American history. Can you tell us about those roots, which you write about fairly extensively, and how they have helped shape the ways that we see things in the United States today?
Right. Well, I wrote a chapter on the Puritan legacy because I felt it was important to investigate. And it's fascinating reading Puritan history and learning more about the mindset of the people who came over. A couple of things come to mind. First, of course, is American exceptionalism and the idea that, you know, the Puritans viewed themselves as a chosen people, coming to America to serve as a beacon of light to all Christendom, and they needed to be a perfect model, in a way, for the rest of the world. At the same time, they had an apocalyptic predisposition, and when things started going wrong during different periods of time, they would often read those things as signs of the impending apocalypse. There was also a sense that, in a way, you could never be good enough. And I talk about this in the book, too, our kind of search for purity. The idea, Puritans believed, you know, it was predestined whether you would go to heaven or hell, so that you didn't really know till you were on your deathbed which direction you were going. So you could work tremendously hard, be righteous, do everything, you know. You know, to be a good religious person, and it didn't mean that you would necessarily go to heaven. So that kind of paranoia and anxiety that also sets root with the America Syndrome. I also talk about the Puritans' expansionism, the way they came to occupy the land, and of course the wars with Native Americans, and the views of themselves as chosen people and those who had inhabited the land previously as unchosen. War, in a sense, was justified by their providential mission. And I think that sense of providential mission is passed down through decades of American history, and it justifies whatever actions are necessary in order to fulfill that providential mission. One other thing I talk about with the Puritans is their use of sermonizing as a political tool on election days and other important days. Puritan leaders would deliver these Jeremiads, which would chastise the community for, you know, their sinful ways and falling away from their mission. But if only we would redeem ourselves, we could fulfill the promise of America. And I think we see these Jeremiads in political uses usage on both the right and the left in the United States continuing up today, and the kind of susceptibility to the sermonizing. Sermons were, in fact, the major form of literature distributed in the colonies for a long time. And I think we're very susceptible to those kinds of messages.
How does the United States compare to other advanced industrial countries in terms of this sense of impending apocalypse? Because, of course, we're all facing the threats of global warming, the dangers of a nuclear era that hasn't come to an end, and so on.
Right. Well, partly I wrote this book to try to understand why Americans seem so much more apocalyptic. I mean, I've lived in England and I've lived in South Asia and, you know, done political work, feminist political work with people from many different countries. And it seems to me, and I, you know, I can't say this absolutely scientifically, although polls tend to show that Americans are more apocalyptic and believe that the end of the world is coming than people in other industrialized countries. So that led me to, you know, ask why. You know, I mean, for example, climate change is an urgent issue. It's extremely serious in terms of its impact on people and nature. And yet, you know, when you go to someplace like Germany or Denmark, people are getting on with the business of making, of transitioning to alternative energies in a much more kind of practical way than the United States, partly because we've had such a strong climate denialist lobby. But there's kind of a sense that we can solve this problem together, as opposed to, oh my God, it's going to be the end of the world.
But could that partially be that politicians in the United States really haven't moved to address climate change in the way that steps have been taken, say, in Denmark?
Yes, absolutely. But I think we do have this apocalyptic predisposition in any case. And another reason for it, I believe, is that we are, you know, the world's military superpower. And the book investigates a lot the role of militarism in shaping our mindset. For, you know, just to give an example, the Pentagon has produced kind of worst case scenarios about climate change and conflict. And too often people accept these worst case scenarios as a given, that this is what the future is going to look like because the military says so. And the military itself might actually be producing a multiple, you know, different scenarios. But the worst case ones are the ones that kind of get picked up and believed in. And I think there's a gullibility for these worst case scenarios that are presented not only by the Pentagon, but of course, you know, by the Trump administration. And people believe that because they're, you know, predisposed to believe it, and predisposed to believe that war is inevitable. And I think when you live in such a heavily militarized country, not only in terms of interventions overseas, but a very highly militarized police, that's only going to get worse under Trump, and immigration enforcement apparatus. When you live in a place where the military dominates politics so much and certainly dominates expenditures and dominates in many ways the media, you get that kind of war mindset, and I think that's it affects us more than we know. I think to live in a country that's in a state of permanent war, and the most powerful military country on the planet.
Do you think there are political implications of that? That when people are told that the only way to deal with the kinds of disruption that climate change is going to bring, and clearly climate change is already bringing major disruption societally to people around the world, and including in the United States, but by framing it a certain way and by having a mindset that war is inevitable, do you think that then makes people much more acquiescent to solutions that might be proffered that are militarized, you know, that we need to militarize the border to keep climate refugees out, for example?
Absolutely. And I've been actually quite disturbed by even many progressives buying into this idea that there are going to be these climate wars and, you know, for example, that the people fleeing from the Middle East or Africa are climate refugees. I think we need to look really carefully at those kinds of narratives. And as you say, there are going to be disruptions, and there are disruptions already. But the kind of militaristic assumption is that people will fight each other in these situations. And it's often based on kind of a racialized narrative of poor people of color, especially poor Africans, fighting over scarce resources. And that's then projected onto climate change. And the idea that people necessarily fight in times of environmental stress instead of cooperate, I think is wrong. I mean, there are examples of people cooperating in times of environmental stress. For example, what we're seeing in Houston right now, what you see often in times of environmental stress among pastoral communities in Africa, is people actually come together to cooperate over water resources rather than fight over them. And when they do fight, it's often because of a breakdown of, institutions, partly from interventions from, external actors for example, top-down state interventions, or even interventions by militaries. So I think, I don't want to read human nature as it's all great and, in times of stress, people are just always wonderful. Absolutely not. But people are complicated, and there's a long history of cooperation. So if we buy this military view that the world's going to descend into a kind of chaos, I think we're really doing ourselves a disservice, and also doing a disservice to the people most vulnerable to climate change. And one thing I'd just like to say about this climate refugee kind of discourse is that certainly there will be, and there already is, climate-related migration. Most researchers say it's within national borders, or likely to be within national borders, not so much across them, and that it can be also temporary, that you flee from a particular event and then return to your home. And whether or not people migrate permanently has to do with so many factors, including possibilities of alternative livelihoods. So that the idea that people are going to be streaming across international borders is really a problematic one. And I was quite distressed to see Syria portrayed as a climate war, for example, and climate, when there was a big refugee crisis in Europe, the idea that those people coming toward Europe on boats from Syria and other places were somehow climate refugees, when really, Syria is a deeply political war, and these are political refugees, they are war refugees. And to naturalize these conflicts and blame them on climate change seems to me we're really, excuse the metaphor, missing the boat and really doing a disservice to refugees.
Well, it seems complicated, too, by the fact that at least for some people, particularly in the United States, who might be arguing against those who are climate deniers, to say that climate is having social effects around the world is an argument that people feel is an important one to make. But I think you're saying that by doing so in a very simplistic way, you miss all of the societal upheaval that may be pre-existing, and obviously in the case of war, the actual war, and having a simplistic way of viewing these events, which erases all the history and inequalities of an area.
Absolutely, and I think we need to look at, whether or not, for example, a particular community or members of a particular community can adapt to climate change or deal with a disaster often has so much to do with pre-existing social inequalities, whether they be gender, race, class, etc., so that you map climate change onto inequality, and certainly those who are already the most vulnerable are likely to be the worst affected. And so rather than kind of fearing that, I think one needs to show greater empathy and solidarity with those people. And I should also say that looking at climate change, this is kind of apocalyptic war lens, distracts us from looking at some of the real battles that are happening now. For example, green grabs in Africa, as biofuel companies want to take over more and more land. Also, land is being bought up for food production by big industrial agricultural firms. And where are the windmills going to be sited? I mean, there's going to be battles over those kinds of things. And in a way, that may be where the real conflicts come in, kind of the political economy of energy investments. And are marginalized communities, are indigenous peoples, land, is that going to be taken? We need to be looking at those kinds of things, not at those people fighting each other just because the weather is bad, which is unfortunately a very popular narrative.
That's the voice of Betsy Hartman. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse War, and Our Call to Greatness. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So returning to the Americanness of apocalypticism, I wonder if you can tell us why you think America and the way, both in terms of elites but also the larger population, buys into these apocalyptical lenses to view our times. To what degree is this linked to the religiosity of America in contrast to comparable countries? And to what degree does it have secular roots?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there are deep religious roots in terms of the Puritans and evangelical Christianity, certainly. And then with the founding, you know, of the United States, our founding fathers were more like deists than, you know, Christians, in the sense that they believed that kind of, you know, that God was guiding the mission, right? And that we had a God-given mission, the new United States. So, you know, whether it's explicitly Christian or it's this more deist belief in a kind of God overlooking everything, or in more secular forms, you know, the kind of biblical book of Revelation, I think, has a role to play here. You know, sometimes I read the narratives about war, climate change, whatever, and they so much seem to, and kind of the destruction of nature and life on Earth, you know, sometimes they feel like there's like a direct line between, even in the secular kind of doomsday environmental narratives, a direct line to the book of Revelation. And I think the book of Revelation has affected us all in many, many ways. The belief, especially, that war is inevitable. So I think they're both secular manifestations and religious manifestations, and the U.S., you know, the kind of borderline between secular and religious is very fuzzy indeed. You know, some people call what we have a civil religion that is based kind of on Christian values without being explicitly Christian, but a belief in kind of our providential mission and that we are the chosen people permeates American culture and American history up through today. So whether we're secular or not, I think we need to investigate where those ideas are coming from and how they influenced, you know, politics on left, right, and center.
Well, you touched on this briefly earlier, but what does the role of the United States as an imperial power, how has that shaped this discourse that tends towards apocalypticism?
Right. Well, certainly, you know, apocalypticism has many sides, but there are two main ones. One is kind of the belief like the end of the world is coming, you know, it's doomsday. The other is this kind of belief in the millennium, the new Jerusalem at the end of the book of Revelation, that all will be set right, you know, Christ will return to earth, or everything's just going to be perfect, you know, we're going to achieve a perfect society. So you have this kind of push and pull between the two, and certainly U.S. imperialism, you know, use kind of the millennial mission, has used and continues to use this idea of the U.S. as the world redeemer. You know, Wilson, President Wilson said, you know, the U.S. needs to make the world safe for democracy, et cetera, et cetera. So this idea that we somehow are the stewards of the planet, of the world. We are the guarantors of peace, that we are going to redeem the world through our democracy, that our values are superior to others. They're part of the imperial package.
And all of those threads that you've just mentioned, one can see right now with Donald Trump. Now, obviously, none of it, as you're saying, started with him. But to what degree do you feel like he pulls these threads together in a most forceful way?
Yeah, forceful is a nice way to put it. Yeah. I mean, in a way, he represents some of the worst aspects of this kind of thinking, right? And that we are good, you know, and they are bad. Part of this America syndrome that I talk about is this idea that there's kind of these, you know, simple dualisms between good and bad, you know, chosen and unchosen. So he's really playing on that, you know, they're the good people and the bad people. We are the good country. We are, you know, America first. We are the greatest, you know. And, you know, of course, even Hillary Clinton said, you know, Donald Trump said he was going to make us great again. And Hillary Clinton said we were already great. But this idea that we're great, you know, Trump is really beefing up. And anybody who says we're not great or wait a minute here, you're suddenly bad, you know. So, you know, he's reinforcing, I think, all the kind of worst aspects of American culture and also our incredible provincialism. You know, and it, of course, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, destroying many aspects of the State Department. I mean, there's just a provincialism that is not good for Americans, not good for the country.
As we've seen recently in Charlottesville, there exists a far right in this country, which didn't come about with Trump, but certainly is being, in many ways, encouraged by Trump. How do you see these ideas that you've mentioned of the coming apocalypse, of American exceptionalism, as it manifests itself on the very far right, the explicitly white supremacist right, the fascist right?
Right. Well, of course, you know, their reading of a multicultural, multiracial United States is in a certain way an apocalyptic one. It's their end of the world, of course, end of their world. And they're wanting to see kind of a all-white paradise again. So there's a kind of millennial aspect to their work, too. But it kind of casts in sharp relief, I think, the white supremacist you know, the persistence of racism in this country and the persistence of who's chosen and who is unchosen, and also the persistence of a kind of white Protestantism. I don't want to brand all Protestants this way, but it's kind of the white Protestant ideal, that male ideal that is the white supremacists are holding up, and all others kind of fall out of it. Even Catholics often fall out of it, Jewish people especially, and of course people of color, and of course also those considered sexually deviant. So there's a kind of a real ugly form of American exceptionalism. It's kind of an American white right-wing exceptionalism that takes its ugliest form in these groups and in what happened in Charlottesville.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Betsy Hartman. She's the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. That's published by Seven Stories Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. So one place where there has been a fairly long history of apocalyptic thinking has been around population and the idea of resource scarcity. I wonder if you could trace for us the origins of these ideas, which then have had enormous influence on both policy and even on activism in the U.S. and beyond.
Right. I devote a chapter in my book to population issues, partly because that's really been my main focus during my career. And I look back, you know, to the Reverend Thomas Malthus in England and his view that, you know, population growth outstrips food production and resources. And you look back from there and see how that particular ideology, became part of the colonial mission. But then you look, this overpopulation ideology in the United States became particularly popular in the 1960s when you have people like Paul Ehrlich, the Stanford biology professor, producing the population bomb. And the view that, you know, overpopulation, and before that in the 40s, also you had writers like William Vogt, writing about, you know, how war and famine and all these things are going to occur from too many people, especially in the global South. So we have a long, you know, history of this kind of thinking from the British, you know, Malthus on up. But it really takes off in the 60s in terms of its impact on the environmental movement, the U.S. environmental movement, this idea that overpopulation is destroying the planet, causing scarcity, and that really, you know, apocalypse is going to happen, famine, water shortages, the earth is going to be totally degraded. Now, of course, many bad things were happening to the environment at the same time. But the idea that it was too many people, especially too many people in the global South causing these problems, became almost a basic credo of the U.S. environmental movement. And if you look back in time, I mean, also post-war in the United States, post-World War II, population also in the global South started becoming identified as a threat because it could give rise to communism if development didn't happen enough. So you have this kind of Cold War view of overpopulation. Then in the 60s, you have the kind of environmental view really coming in strongly. And together, it's a toxic mix and leading to a very, very important and influential ideology, which remains so today in the United States and among many well-meaning people as well, I should say. A misunderstanding of the role of, I mean, a very simplistic understanding of the kind of people versus nature, that people are necessarily bad and that, you know, women having too many babies, especially women of color having too many babies in the global South is what's causing, is ruining nature, you know, and causing scarcity. And not looking at the complex interactions between people and nature, and which people are destroying nature. You know, what about the role of people who are actually protecting nature, conserving resources, peasants terracing the land. So this kind of dark view of human nature and especially dark view of people of color in countries with high fertility. And as we know, fertility tends to drop as development and urbanization and education proceed. So it's no mystery why birth rates come down. And in the 1990s, in the kind of international security world, there started to be a lot of attention focused on overpopulation supposedly causing resource scarcity, which supposedly then caused war and political violence, especially as poor people migrated from their already degraded lands into cities and became youth bulges of angry young men, et cetera, et cetera. You can kind of trace these narratives, which now are very much present in this kind of climate war discourse. And so it's so easy to kind of, it's an easy way to think or not think about really what are these complex interactions. Or we might see those complex interactions in our own localities. We might understand who's doing the most environmental damage in a particular city, like the big toxic coal refinery, you know, or the oil refinery, or, you know, who's preventing solar panels from being built and those kinds of things. But then Americans tend to project this overpopulation lens onto the rest of the world, especially the rest of the global South and see that scarcity and resource degradation, they tend to think, oh, it's all those people over there, and moreover, those people will probably come to get what we have, and therefore we will, you know, we will face scarcity. There's this incredible fear of scarcity in this country, which is ironic given that we're really one of the most abundant countries on earth. So, and these kinds of ideas, you know, are taught in American schools, they're taught in high schools, they're on AP exams, they're, you know, in environmental studies, and you read some of these textbooks, and people are taught that, you know, it's people versus resources, and rapid population growth means less resources, and there's kind of not a very close attention paid to the role of technological change, for example, or institutional change, and how that mediates between human and nature relations, and it's kind of a gloom and doom picture. And with a very easy solution, supposedly, oh, if those people just take contraceptives, you know, if those women just start using contraceptives and have smaller families, then everything will be put right. And it's often presented in this kind of win-win, you know, it's going to be women should get empowered, be able to use contraceptives, and then everything's going to be put right. And, you know, I'm all for everybody having access to contraception and safe abortion services and reproductive health care. Absolutely. But that's not the solution for major environmental and social and political problems. I mean, it's really vital for women's bodily integrity and their health and their family's health to have access to reproductive health care and contraception. But the idea that that's going to solve all these social and environmental problems is really, really, it's a deeply held belief, but it's deeply, deeply problematic.
Do you think this is indicative of something, and all of this apocalyptic thinking, in fact, speaks to the lack of a prevalence of a radical critique of inequality and the way that inequality relates to how we see nature? I mean, not that there hasn't been apocalyptic thinking on the left in the United States and elsewhere, but what you're describing is a kind of environmentalism on the cheap, where the issues that people see, you know, obviously people have absolutely legitimate concern about nature and absolutely legitimate concern about resource depletion and so on. But then the way that people tend to understand these issues is so simplistic and strips out all the inequalities that help structure the way that nature is used or not used, or, you know, who has an effect on it or not. It seems like that so much of what you're talking about describes a way of seeing all of the roiling dislocations of the world we live in without really getting a handle on them.
Absolutely. And again, I think this goes back to our provincialism and also the lack of exposure to, you know, world history, to environmental history, to history in other places, including, you know, in history, you know, within our country. You know, for example, the wilderness ethic, the idea that, you know, the West was this great wilderness and that we had a right to conquer it and then protect it, not realizing that, you know, protecting so-called pristine nature often meant like kicking out the Native Americans or the Mexican Americans who had lived there for years. So we don't even know our own history of kind of environmental racism among some of the, you know, great, supposedly great thinkers of our times. So, you know, if you look at things with a different lens, I mean, I think it's so important for people to put on, you know, glasses that show inequality, that show political economy, that show who are the, you know, that it's not just a question of, for example, of human beings overshooting carrying capacity, you know, what's happening in a particular area? What are the outside forces? What is the role of the military to an environmental devastation? What is the role of war? That's often left out, you know, of the conversation, especially here in the United States. And, you know, of course, ironically, the Pentagon happens to be the biggest user of transportation fuel in the world. So one of, you know, one of the big carbon culprits. And yeah, so yes. And I think if we assume that things are more complicated, if we can get over, partly Americans are often taught that, again, as part of, I don't know if it's exactly apocalyptic thinking, but in a certain way, millennial thinking, that we also can make it. We can be great because we're Americans, you know, and not seeing the kind of that it's impossible for lots of people to make it. You know, this can be a very cruel culture that way, too, that there's not much sympathy for the underdog. And so we can kind of always believe, or, you know, those of us who have resources can believe that, you know, we're somehow going to make it, that we're special, that we have a chosen role without looking at what's really going on around us and what, you know, why do we have resources and why do other people not have them? But it's not their fault. I mean, one thing about this America syndrome thing is we tend to believe that, you know, we're the victims, right? I mean, even if we're the perpetrators, we tend to believe we're the victims. Americans, I think, you know, like to wallow in victimhood in a way and not look at, you know, okay, who's perpetrating what on whom? Who are the real victims in these situations? And what are people doing to fight back?
Betsy Cartman is my guest. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. Seven Stories Press is the publisher, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wonder if you could say a bit more about how nature has been seen through the lens of what you're calling the America Syndrome, but an apocalyptic outlook that couples American exceptionalism with a belief that the end is coming, and also linked to expansion and war.
Right. Well, you know, I describe, you know, in the book, I say there are kind of seven deadly synergies that are part of this America syndrome. And one of them, and I think it's a very important one, is nature is kind of a fractured mirror. And so we have kind of these conflicting views of nature, but they kind of merge together. One is that, you know, nature is this pristine wilderness, again, where people never inhabited it, you know. You know, for example, that Native Americans were kicked out of, you know, Yosemite, even though they actually, you know, Native Americans had made that area so beautiful. So nature is pristine, or nature is to be conquered and used as an economic resource, you know, to fuel the great America, you know, economic machine. So that's another view of nature, of course, and or nature as kind of a sublime escape, you know, and the famous Puritan theologian Jonathan Edwards used to find kind of solace and religious inspiration in nature. So nature is kind of, you know, God's gift to us. It's where we are redeemed, is another view. And then kind of reading nature like the Book of Revelation that, you know, that it's going to be destroyed. It is being destroyed. It's the end of the world, and kind of this bleak view. And so often those kinds of views coexist in our minds, I believe, and leads to kind of, I don't know, an uneasiness and a kind of lack of historical understanding of our relationship with the land. Of course, you know, when the Puritans came over, Native Americans, many had died previously from, you know, European diseases. And so this idea that we live in an unoccupied land, you know, the Puritans came and found fewer people than would have been there had, you know, there not been contact with the Europeans. So this idea that we have this kind of vast empty space and I should add to that, and I talk about this in the book, the role of kind of the frontier, you know, that we chase the frontier across the country, and then the frontier, you know, we reach the end of the frontier, and that leads to kind of fears of scarcity. And in the process of, you know, exploring the frontier or conquering the frontier, of course, you know, there's major genocide against Native Americans and Mexicans and not facing up to that reality. And I think people are always like the bottom line, reaching the frontier, the bottom line, this fear of scarcity, you know, that, you know, you're also, there's not a safety net in this country to speak of. And so you're going to reach the end of your bank account. And then where will you go? Like, you know, the frontier has been reached. The bottom has been dropped out. There's scarcity. And it leads to a lot of fear. And sometimes I wonder if Europeans, and this perhaps is a gross exaggeration, but especially those who live in more solid kind of social welfare states, if they're less inclined to be apocalyptic because they have a social support system, the bottom is not going to drop out. There's not going to be scarcity, you know, especially if you have access to healthcare, you know, single payer system, and you know health is a basic right and you're going to receive it for the rest of your life. What does that do to your psychology? So I think the frontiers, both environmental, psychological, economic, kind of mixed together and, you know, leading to this profound fear of scarcity.
Well, it's interesting because the way that people, Americans, tend to even think about how they will deal with these scenarios, these doomsday scenarios, is very individualistic, not surprisingly. And so there is a whole booming industry, in fact, in different kinds of ways of coping with the end times, you know, whether, and I guess it fits people's place on the class hierarchy, whether, you know, you're going to go into the woods with your guns and camp out, or those people who, the wealthy who plan to just relocate somewhere else, whether it's to the South Pacific or New Zealand, where they expect to sort of ride out the coming apocalypse.
Yeah, yes, and of course, one of the ironies is some of those rich people are, they're making condos in old bomb silos, you know, nuclear bomb silos, you know. So, you know, for me, that's one of the great ironies of the age. Yeah, so this idea that you escape individually or, you know, with a small community and you don't stand together to actually create the kind of social changes that would lead to a better life for you and for everyone around you, you know, it's a sad commentary. I think that we have such a strong survivalist movement, kind of, and again, that also goes back to this idea of the rugged pioneer on the frontier, right? You know, that kind of the rugged American ideal, which is predicated on violence, actually. And of course, a lot of the people who are into survivalism, not all of them, but are very much into guns too. Like, you know, got to protect our territory, you know.
And while that conjures up images of the right, you can also see strains of that amongst progressives and the left too. Reading your book made me think of the millennium bug, Y2K, how when clocks and machines had to switch from 1999 to the year 2000, there was a fear amongst people on the right, and it seeped into the progressive sphere, and people didn't really question it very much, that everything was going to melt down. Industrial society would melt down, and people ran out and bought Bunsen burners, and there was a kind of a panic.
Yeah, I remember that, you know. And interesting, like one population group did a kind of Y2K thing, you know, that the world population was passing the 6 billion mark and it was going to be as much of kind of an apocalyptic, you know, event as this computer meltdown. Yeah, no, and I think, you know, this apocalyptic syndrome is not just a right-wing phenomenon, for sure. And, you know, I partly wrote this book because I was very, you know, affected by survivalism myself, not of the kind of gun-toting variety, but, you know, it infects all of us, I think, maybe not all of us, but in some way, you know, and it's important to see that and try to understand it in yourself. I think it opens new horizons, actually, to be able to look at the future in a, you know, not in a kind of Pollyannish way, but in a more considered way.
Well, what are the political implications, looking back at the 60s and 70s, looking at today, in getting entangled in a sort of apocalyptical outlook, no matter how bad society may, in fact, be? You know, it's quite a struggle, in effect, not to resist the pull of the apocalyptic when you see major cities flooded out over and over again, these catastrophes in the wealthiest country on Earth. So it's hard not to resist that pull. But, you know, looking back to the late 60s, early 1970s, when people really were fearing an apocalypse, a lot of, it seems like at least some number of people withdrew from political action or direct political action anyway, and went into personal or small group retreats, whether it was sort of back to the land or so on, and withdrew. What do you see the political implications of this kind of outlook for the left today?
Certainly, the back to the land movement was complicated, and there was a tendency for escapism and survivalism. But there was also, many people who did the back to the land thing ended up, staying in those areas and getting involved in, making a livelihood, getting involved in politics, et cetera. So it wasn't all escapism, or let's put it this way, sometimes the escapism led to actually more engagement. In general, I think there was a lack of kind of good race, class, gender politics in many of the kind of in much of the communal movement, and also a failure to see kind of the millennial aspects and also the kind of repeat of this kind of pioneer myth. Today, I have to say, I've had a lot of students involved in, alternative agriculture, and there seems to be much more of a critical lens in terms of, building food sovereignty, getting people in urban areas, poor people, greater access to food, good, healthy food, the kind of urban farm projects you see, for example, in neighboring Holyoke here in Massachusetts, are really do a wide range of activities. And so I'm kind of hopeful that I think we do need to develop an alternative agriculture, especially in an era of climate change, an alternative food system, less intensive fossil fuel use in agriculture, so that there are lots of possibilities. You don't want to say no to utopian experimentation, but the more practical it can be, the more engaged it can be, the more critical it can be, and the more it deals with issues of inequality, like you mentioned before, I think the less it will be kind of a survivalist movement and more of a real movement that helps, helps change the country. So I'm excited about that, actually. And I think, people working on climate justice, environmental justice, there's so many good things going on, too. And one thing I would just say about the whole Trump thing and this apocalyptic moment, and especially, his climate denialism making it even worse, I was really felt very apocalyptic after the election myself, but it's just been so heartening to see all the political activism, rising up against the Trump administration, against the white supremacists. And also for, creating sound climate policy. So there's a sense that, actually people are really energized. And I think that energy is one of the best kind of antidotes to apocalyptic despair. Because if you're energetic and you get involved and you get engaged in political action, in fighting back, but also in creating new institutions, new ways of living, I think you just tend to be less prone to despair and more prone to hope, not in a naive sense, but, people do solve problems, and collective action can solve problems. And I think we should not forget that. And individual solutions really don't go very far, and we need to really rebuild community and move forward.
Well, that's a pretty hopeful note, so let's end right there. I've been speaking with Betsy Hartman. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. That's published by Seven Stories Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include Reproductive Rights and Wrongs, and she's Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. Betsy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sasha.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Hey.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha, Lily, and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.